an imitation chatbot I've created to help me make this series on modern bakery, in which I'll be asking why it's no longer punished and often rewarded.
Sounds good. What's it called?
Everything is fake and nobody cares. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
That sounds too good to be true.
This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 2nd of April. This is Today with Nick Robinson and Emma Barnett.
Good morning. The headlines today. NASA's Artemis 2 moon mission has blasted off, with its crew heading deeper into space than any astronaut has gone before.
3, 2, 1, booster ignition and liftoff. The crew of Artemis 2 now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
Over the course of the programme, we'll be reliving that moment, watching the mission's progress and discussing what happens next for this remarkable mission. President Trump has used a televised address to say that another 2 to 3 weeks of US strikes will bring Iran back to the Stone Ages.
Everyone is talking about it, and tonight I'm pleased to say that these core strategic objectives are nearing completion.
We'll be hearing from a former chief of staff to President Trump and former Foreign Secretary David Miliband, who is visiting Lebanon, who warns that the globe is facing a food security bombshell.
Also, coming up in today's programme, have a listen to this.
I wanted to not feel depressed and anxious. And here was an influencer telling me how to not feel depressed and anxious.
And did you get really into that particular influencer?
They became a father figure to me. So I had like a painting of them on my wall.
Wow. What happens when impressionable men get sucked into the toxic so-called manosphere? A rare insight from someone who went all the way in and came all the way out. How do they escape it? All that and more to come throughout the programme. But first, the BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
NASA's first mission carrying astronauts to the moon in more than 50 years has blasted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. Artemis 2 is due to take the crew further into space than anyone has gone before. The astronauts won't land on the moon, but will pass its far side on a mission which NASA hopes will pave the way for a lunar landing in 2 years' time. Our science editor Rebecca Morell was watching the launch in Florida.
3, 2, 1, booster ignition and liftoff.
As the four astronauts headed skywards, leaving a plume of white smoke behind, the Artemis 2 commander, Reid Wiseman, spoke to Mission Control.
Houston Integrity, good last jettison, great view.
These are the first humans to head to the moon since 1972. Their first day will be spent in high orbit around the Earth, where they're checking out their spacecraft. If all looks okay, the go-ahead will be given for a blast of their main engine so they can begin their journey to the moon. During their 10-day mission, they'll be passing around its far side, the side we never see from Earth, before heading home and splashing down in the Pacific Ocean.
President Trump has said the United States is getting very close to completing its military objectives in Iran. In a televised address from the White House, Mr. Trump said there would be a further 2 to 3 weeks of extremely hard strikes against Tehran. After his speech, oil prices rose, with Brent crude up by 5% at $106 a barrel. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman was listening.
This appeared to be President Trump's mission nearly accomplished moment, but with the extraordinary caveat that Iran's grip over oil transit through the Strait of Hormuz was essentially not America's problem. Mr. Trump suggested the US could wrap up its military operations soon, but in the meantime, he threatened overwhelming destruction.
We are on track to complete all of America's military objectives shortly, very shortly. We're going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong.
Despite saying Iran had been crushed militarily, Mr. Trump still demanded that it do a deal with the United States without setting out anything about the terms. He once again vowed that if it didn't, the US would bomb all of Iran's power plants.
The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, is due to host a virtual meeting of 35 foreign ministers today to discuss diplomatic measures that could be taken to restore freedom of navigation through the Strait of Hormuz. The United States won't be involved. The motoring organisation, the RAC, has said there were record monthly rises in the prices of petrol and diesel in the UK in March, with petrol up by 20 pence a litre and diesel 40 pence higher. The government has withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors in England. The Prime Minister had given the Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, 48 hours to call off a six-day strike due to start next Tuesday or face losing the training posts. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
A pay and jobs deal offered by the government to the BMA included a commitment to create 1,000 more training posts this year for newly qualified doctors to progress in their careers. With a lot more applicants than places last year, the BMA said some doctors were facing unemployment. The Department of Health said because the BMA had not agreed to call off the strike and put the offer to members, it wasn't possible for the system to deliver the new training posts and manage the NHS safely during strike action. The BMA said it had consistently maintained that industrial action could be postponed if there was a genuinely credible offer. Neither side has formally walked away from talks, though the possibility of any further negotiations before the strike looks remote.
The Conservatives have said they would scrap taxes on carbon, which are levied on British industry, if they were in government. Critics say such a move would cost the Treasury billions of pounds. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says carbon taxes are driving deindustrialisation and she would axe them. Her party argues the levies place a heavy burden on energy-intensive industries such as manufacturing or the chemicals and refining businesses, but as well as encouraging companies to shift to less polluting practices, the taxes also currently raise around £4 billion annually for the Treasury. Critics warn that UK exporters would still face carbon charges from the EU. The government said the policy would hammer industry and leave working people picking up the bill.
Black boxes, which monitor a person's driving, will be fitted to all new Motability vehicles driven by someone under the age of 30 from mid-April. The scheme allows disabled people to use their mobility allowance to lease a new car. Those running it say the change will keep costs down after some tax breaks were removed in the last budget. But Eva Hannah, who lives in Northern Ireland, where black boxes were made mandatory in September, says she gets negative black box reports for her driving because she uses hand controls.
I've noticed that even when I'm just stopping at a junction, it'll say that I've braked really hard, or if I'm pulling off, it'll say that I've pulled off really hard. You know I'm not a dangerous driver. I'm not braking harshly or anything like that. But there is a difference whenever I drive. I'll always get knocked down a bit on the smoothness.
New rules to make it easier to cancel subscriptions have been announced by the government. From early next year, consumers will be given a 14-day cooling-off period after the end of a trial period or when an annual subscription renews automatically. Ministers say the changes could save the average person nearly £170 a year for every unwanted subscription.
Thank you, Jane. It's now 7 minutes past six. Let's go over to the BBC Weather Centre. Ben Rich is waiting for us there. Morning, Ben.
Morning, Nick. Thank you very much. And good morning to you. Quite a mixed Easter weekend in prospect. There's some rain, some strong winds, particularly in the north of the UK through Saturday night. A bit of snow over high ground in the north, but equally some sunshine, the best of that towards the south and the east. You can check your Easter weekend forecast, of course, on the BBC Weather app. So let's focus on what is to come today for Thursday. Not a bad looking day, actually. Some dry weather, some spells of sunshine, although cloud and rain will spread into the northwest of the UK later in the day. Let's begin our forecast across the southwest of England, because this is probably where we're going to see the best of the sunshine today. It's likely to be a story of blue skies from dawn till dusk in some areas, just a little patchy cloud here and there. For the southeast of England, for Wales, the Midlands, eastern England, all of northern England, it's a mix of patchy cloud and sunny spells. It will be predominantly dry. We've got a few showers right now across some eastern parts. Many of those will fade. We do just keep the chance for the odd light shower as we go into the afternoon. Now, for Northern Ireland and for southwest Scotland and northern Scotland, quite a cold start here. We will see some sunny spells through the morning, but cloud and rain will spread from the west as we head into the afternoon with a strengthening breeze. And for eastern Scotland, well, actually, not a bad day. Some sunny spells, more cloud into the afternoon, but many places here will stay dry. Temperatures north to south across the UK around 8 to 12 degrees, but we will see cloud and outbreaks of rain with some brisk winds spreading southwards and eastwards across all parts during tonight.
Ben, thanks very much. It's 9 minutes past six. At around 10 o'clock last night, 5 o'clock in the afternoon at Cape Canaveral in Florida, things started to get exciting. A huge launch clock near the Kennedy Space Center was showing 90 minutes to go until the launch of Artemis II, NASA's historic moon mission. But it was not going to be a relaxing 90 minutes for anyone involved. No. Within the next hour, NASA reported first an issue with the flight termination system, then a communications problem, both of which would stop the launch from going ahead if not solved. But technicians managed to solve them, and we were half an hour out from launch time, which was set at 6:24 local time in Florida. Then there was a third glitch. A battery had overheated in the launch abort system. With 15 minutes to go, NASA's launch commentator, Daryl Nell, then had this good news.
There are two batteries on the LAS. One of the two batteries reported an out-of-family temperature, and it was very much out-of-family. And so they checked their data, and they have good, solid data, they reported, that tells them that this is an instrumentation failure, that there's something wrong with the sensor. So now we are clear as far as that constraint is concerned.
Phew. Launch was go. But we still weren't into that famous T-minus 10 minutes countdown. Final checks had to be completed.
Thank you, Charlie. This is Victor. We are going for our families.
MS-1.
This is Christina. We are going for our teammates.
MS-2.
This is Jeremy. We are going for all humanity.
All right, Charlie. Your Artemis 2 crew is go for launch.
I copy that. Reed, Victor, Christina, and Jeremy, on this historic mission, you take with you the heart of this Artemis team, the daring spirit of the American people and our partners across the globe, and the hopes and dreams of a new generation. Good luck. Godspeed, Artemis II. Let's go.
With everyone ready, the official clock was started.
3, 2, 1, mark. GLS mainline has been initiated.
T-minus 10 minutes and counting.
On a clear and sunny day, the footage showed the spacecraft being prepared, the supportive arms being withdrawn, the engines starting. Then finally, there were less than 30 seconds to go.
GLS, go for ALS.
Great call out. The rocket is on its own. Four brave explorers ready to ride the most powerful rocket NASA has ever launched. 20. Sound suppression water is flowing.
15.
And here we go. 10, 9, 8, 7. RS-25 engines lit. 4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition. And lift off. The crew of Artemis II now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
On a clear and sunny day, the footage showed the spacecraft being prepared, the four minutes being prepared, the supportive arms being withdrawn, the engines starting, 30 seconds to go. And from then on, as you've just heard, it was a rapid ascent into space for the four astronauts.
Communication signal transfer confirmed as Integrity and its crew go supersonic. Approaching 90 seconds into the Artemis II mission. Integrity is 14 miles in altitude, 8 miles downrange, traveling more than 2,600 miles per hour.
And then, less than 4 minutes into the mission, they were in space.
3 minutes 50 seconds into the flight of Artemis II, Wiseman, Glover, Cook, and Hansen cross the boundary to space with good comm checks.
And we have a beautiful moonrise. We're headed right at it.
Now, isn't that something nice to wake up to? Professor Kevin Fong is going to be joining us for much of the programme and draw some really fascinating parallels with 1968, another troubled year in which he argues that watching a successful launch of that sort brought some much needed hope. Much more on that mission as the programme develops. But let's now look at the morning papers. If you're getting a paper edition rather than looking on your phone or tablet. Of course, these were printed before the successful launch of Artemis. A star-spangled spanner in the works is the tongue-twisting headline in the Metro. It's how they describe President Trump's threat to withdraw the United States from NATO. The Telegraph leads on its exclusive interview with Mr. Trump, in which he calls the alliance a paper tiger. It's an interesting word, exclusive interview, isn't it? Where it seems that almost anybody can ring the man and get a quick interview with him. The Guardian says the threats are some of his most determined to date and have left NATO facing its worst crisis in its 77-year history. According to The Eye, there is despair amongst European governments. One diplomat is quoted as saying the situation plays into Putin's hands.
The Financial Times leads on Sir Keir Starmer's comments that Britain will pivot more closely towards the European Union after what's described as weeks of taunts from Donald Trump. Starmer prepares a Brexit betrayal. That's how the Daily Mail puts it in its editorial. It says the Prime Minister is using the conflict in the Middle East as a convenient smokescreen. The Sun offers similar analysis, claiming Sir Keir's position is a cynical move to rejoin the EU by the back door.
The Times reports that Nigel Farage is expected to commit Reform UK to the triple lock on pensions. The policy means that state pensions go up in line with inflation, earnings, or 2.5%, whichever is the highest. The paper says it's a sign the party is looking to bolster support amongst older voters.
A striking photo on the front of the Daily Mail with the headline Portrait of a Broken Man, featuring Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. The paper says he was seen driving near his new home in Norfolk as it emerged police looking into allegations of misconduct in public office have approached Crown prosecutors for early investigative advice. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor denies any wrongdoing.
The Daily Star says Japan really cleaned up at Wembley on Tuesday night by beating England for the first time and by their fans, wait for it, tidying up the terraces. Stadium officials were so swept away by their efforts, get it? They posted footage online of litter being put into bags, along with a caption, "Thank you." The Star's leader said there's a lot we can learn from the Japanese, not just on the football pitch.
I'm a keen litter picker. I have one of those claws. It is 16 minutes past six.
President Trump has made a primetime address to the country, designed, it seems, to reassure voters at home, blaming his war of choice for the fact they're now paying more than $4 a gallon for gas.
I've made clear from the beginning of Operation Epic Fury that we will continue until our objectives are fully achieved. Thanks to the progress we've made, I can say tonight that we are on track to complete all of America's military objectives shortly, very shortly. We're going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong.
People are listening all over the globe, of course, to see what the president would have to say about the progress of the war, not least in the Gulf itself. Our correspondent in Doha, Katie Watson, joins us. What's been the reaction in the region, Katie?
Well, I think the reaction is best measured this morning in the missiles and drones. Israel's military said earlier today its air defences were operating to intercept missiles in Iran. There have been strikes overnight here in the UAE. A few hours ago, they said they were fending off incoming missile and drone threats. In Abu Dhabi, there was an incident, no injuries. Bahrain alarms have been sounding. And we've just heard in Baghdad, the US embassy said that Iran-lined militia groups may carry out attacks in central Baghdad. US citizens have been urged to leave. And I think that's exactly what the Gulf fears. They might not be talking publicly. They don't want to get drawn into a war that they didn't start. But, you know, there was a joint statement just a few days ago saying as much that they condemned attacks, not just from Iran, but through their proxies, armed factions they support in the region. I think that fear really is that any kind of proxy armed groups could just escalate the war. And speaking to Qataris earlier this week, there was very much a sense of this needs to be de-escalated now. And I don't think that speech we heard from Trump is in any way showing that's going to happen.
We'll hear more analysis of the speech from our North America correspondent a bit later in the programme. But the sense, Katie, they didn't really answer the questions that people might have been answering about when and how the war ends.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the main takeaway is that the US will leave Iran within 2 to 3 weeks. That would actually, you know, extend the conflict past that 4 to 6 week deadline that had been given at the start of the war. I mean, certainly here in the Gulf, you know, he thanked the UAE, he thanked Gulf allies, he talked about the fact that they've been great, we won't let them get hurt or fail in any way, shape or form, but certainly this, you know, I don't think there's much trust in what's going to happen, and that fear of, yes, the war needs to end, but also that threat of Iran needs to end, and this part of the Middle East, which is so used to being quite stable and isolated from conflict, is a very changed place.
KJ Watson in Doha, thank you.
19 minutes past six. More now on how those words from Donald Trump caused the oil price to spike upwards. Sean Farrington has more on that and the rest of the morning's business news. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Emma. Yeah, after hearing what Nick and Katie were talking about there, Donald Trump's words, just after he spoke, the price of a barrel of Brent crude oil jumped over 5%. So it's now over $107 a barrel this morning. Let's just get straight into this with Anne-Sophie Corbeau, who's the global research scholar at the Centre on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University, former head of gas analysis at BP as well. Anne-Sophie, morning to you. What was it about his words that made the oil price move like that?
Well, good morning. Well, I think, I mean, what he's saying is that there is going to be a campaign to destroy every energy infrastructure in Iran for the next 2 or 3 weeks. But what he has not said is how we open the Strait of Hormuz. That is still completely unclear. Also, what he's planning to do is very likely to create a retaliation, to lead to retaliation, and probably also to hit energy infrastructure in the Gulf. We all remember what happened in Qatar about 2 weeks ago, whereby the energy infrastructure, in particular the LNG liquefaction plants, were hit. Two of them are damaged and are not going to be back online before the next 3 to 5 years. So this is exactly, I think, what is driving the prices upward right now. However, what this price, the 107 that you were mentioning, is not actually reflecting is a very long disruption of the flows through the Strait of Hormuz.
So on to the Strait of Hormuz, in maybe a bit more detail, Anne-Sophie, given what you know of the region, what will the oil-producing, gas-producing companies and nations there need to see to be able to have confidence to start ramping up production again?
Well, I mean, they need to be sure that they can actually transit through the Strait of Hormuz without being harassed, without mines being on the water, without having basically Iran threatening them. What we have seen over the past few weeks is that some oil or LPG cargoes, this is an oil product, were able to go through. However, in order to do so, they had to pay a fee. My understanding is that fee can be up to $2 million per ship. So this is quite substantial, actually. And I think what Gulf countries may actually fear is that because the US has said we are just going to leave and let you, the Gulf producing countries, as well as your customers in Asia and in Europe, deal with the Strait of Hormuz, they may have now to pay this fee in order to get ships out of the Gulf.
Is that a longer term solution that can work? Obviously, maybe it hasn't been how it's been used in the past. But when we see that, you know, the UK and the foreign secretary here is going to be leading a meeting of 35 countries' representatives about what can happen next in the Strait of Hormuz, can paying tolls be a solution?
This is definitely not going to be welcomed by both the Gulf producers and their customers, both in Asia and Europe and elsewhere in the world. I mean, this is actually the worst-case solution. I mean, the best-case solution would be that the Iranian regime would fall, but that doesn't seem to be actually even the objective of the 2 to 3 weeks war that the president is intending to do. So we are now going to a very uncertain world where the regime is still in place. Yes, they have fewer weapons than before. They still have the uranium, which means that in 6 months or maybe 1 year from now, maybe Israel and the US will decide that they want to have another war again. So we are in a very uncertain world, and the risk over the Strait of Hormuz remains. But most importantly, the risk of energy infrastructure in the Gulf during these next 2 or 3 weeks remains. And that is actually even more important because, as we have seen with the attack on Ras Laffan, if you have an LNG plant or an oil plant or anything which is very crucial damage, we are talking about years of disruptions, not
and
weeks.
Just
of
on that briefly, Anne-Sophie, have expectations for where the oil price will be many, many months down the line changed because of this?
Well, I mean, everything has gone upward, but what we are not seeing is the curve basically pricing a very long-term disruption. And this is actually, I think, the main concern of everybody here, that the price could actually increase much more because, I mean, if and especially if the Strait of Hormuz issue is not solved, because at best, I mean, we would be looking at least 10% of oil which would be removed. Because the oil producers, notably Saudi Arabia, is trying to find other ways to bring the product to the market. For LNG, it's impossible to bring the LNG outside of the Gulf. So this is 20% of the global LNG market, which is gone.
So those concerns
as the Strait of Hormuz.
Still very much there. Anne-Sophie, thank you for your time this morning. Anne-Sophie Corbeau there from Columbia University. Some big changes for how people use subscriptions. There's going to be regulation to protect customers from what's been called subscription traps that have been announced by the Department for Business and Trade. Have you ever signed up for a free trial and then forgotten to cancel it when you didn't want to continue after that period? From spring next year, customers can expect to find it a bit easier to do those cancellations, get reminders before the free trials end as well. What does it mean, though, for subscription-based businesses? Our view of subscriptions. Timo Bolt is the founder and chief executive of Gusto, the subscription-based meal kit business. Timo, good morning. How does this change things for businesses that might rely on free trials and subscriptions to a certain extent to attract customers?
Morning. Thanks for having me. Look, Gusto was built around the customer being in control, and that's exactly where the legislation is trying to get to. And so I'm excited. I think this is good for customers.
If you've got something like a food kit that you're delivering, and after one of your free trials, that some food goes out, and then within the 14-day cool-off period, somebody says, actually, I want to cancel. Is that going to have to change how you communicate with the customer and potentially how you deliver your food after a free trial ends?
No, nothing changes for us. That's exactly how we have been working for the last couple of years. Gusto is designed to work around people's lives. So whether that's choosing recipes each week, skipping when life gets busy, or simply buying a one-off box with no strings attached, be my guest.
Well, we've got you, Timo. We've been talking a lot about food prices. How are you seeing them impact the prospects for this year and the food that you need for your business?
Look, we are concerned by the rise in cost, transportation costs, food costs. Food costs are hugely linked to energy prices. We are fighting for customers to keep them protected, and we're really hoping the war gets resolved as quickly as possible to protect families across the UK. If it continues for long, this is painful.
Where are you expecting to see the biggest pressures?
When we are sourcing all our meat here from the UK, and therefore we're to a large extent hedged, but there are things you have to import, and the further away these goods come from, I mean, the more cost customers incur. And so we're working pretty hard to just create meals that are as British as possible, as seasonal as possible.
Of course. Are you expecting though that prices will be going up this year for you?
No, it's too early to tell. I mean, if this gets resolved quickly, I don't think you see a dramatic rise in inflation. However, if instability continues in the region, we no doubt will see quite substantial food inflation here in the UK.
Timo, thank you for your time. Timo Bolt there, Chief Executive Founder of Gusto. Obi Ejikemi is the Global Equities Fund Manager at Carmignac. Morning, Obi.
Good morning, Sean.
Now, I know people are seeing a lot of space headlines this morning. They might not be catching what might be the biggest one in the business world this morning, that SpaceX, Elon Musk's space firm, looks like it's confidentially filed to list on a stock market over in America. Could be the biggest ever listing on record. What is that really all about?
Well, for me, Sean, it's just it's the pinnacle of what we've been seeing in the stock market over the last 5, even 10 years, which is innovative tech firms coming to the market and being some of the biggest leading companies in the market. And this would be, I guess, the sort of the icing on the top, but it's a continuation of a trend that we've been seeing for some years. It's been dominated, actually, to be fair, with some of the companies that have been linked to artificial intelligence and the technological developments in that space. But this would just be another marker, especially for the US stock market, that innovation is live and kicking.
And some of those Musk innovations that we've talked about in recent years, reusing launchers and parts of the takeoff process and potentially the rockets themselves. We're seeing that a little bit in this Artemis 2 story that took off last night in the United States. It's very linked, aren't they? The innovations and the business models behind this.
They are, and I think with every technological development that we're seeing, all of the stuff is allowing us to do a lot more. So, if you go back 10, 20 years, getting a satellite into space would have been something which was almost extraordinary. And now we're able to do it relatively cost-effectively, return the parts of the shuttle back to Earth and send them back up again. I mean, that is something that is almost like getting on a bus and going down the street today. And so, these technological advancements are allowing us to do a lot more with very similar resources, and I think there's more of this to come.
Yeah, not that far-fetched that kids of today could be seeing these images this morning and being in them much more frequently in the years down the line. Just a quick one on Andrew Bailey, Governor of the Bank of England's comments. He's not so sure that everybody's getting the interest rate prospects for the year quite right.
Yeah, I would say, his comments, I think the market getting ahead and sort of predicting that there'll be a hike in interest rates potentially in April as a result of some of the geopolitics around the world. I think he's trying to sort of calm market nerves around some of those fears and, probably highlighting the fact that, look, at the end of the day, UK is struggling a little bit on the growth front. The inflation dynamic has actually been in a downward trend. Mm. And so I think he's just trying to get ahead of the market so that we don't see asset prices move too far in the wrong direction.
Obi, thanks for your time. Obi Edukebi there from Carmignac.
And Sean, thank you. It's 29 minutes to 7. Here's Mike with the sports news.
Nick, thank you. Good morning. Let's start with the Women's Champions League, where the holders are through to the semi-finals.
On the touchline are asking for the whistle to be blown, and there it does indeed go. And the Chelsea players fall to the ground in disappointment. Their Champions League journey is over at the hand of bitter City rivals Arsenal.
Yes, Arsenal have moved another step closer to defending their Women's Champions League title after they beat Chelsea 3-2 on aggregate in the second leg of their quarter-final last night. Ailey Barber reports from Stamford Bridge.
Arsenal's defence of their Women's Champions League crown continues despite defeat on the night at Stamford Bridge as they restricted Chelsea to few opportunities, but they did have to survive a late flurry of chances. Van Domselaar pulled off a number of superb saves and the post was rattled twice in the final 10 minutes. Nuskin then did put the ball in the net, but in added on time it was too little, too late. A flash point as McCabe pulled the hair of Chelsea's Thompson. Nothing given, much to Sonia Bampastor's fury, which saw her sent off, but it is Arsenal who progressed 3-2 on aggregate. They will face either Lyon or Wolfsburg in the semi-finals.
Well, as Ailey says, all the focus after the match was on that hair pull by Arsenal's Katie McCabe on the Chelsea forward Alyssa Thompson at the very end of the match, a foul that wasn't even deemed a yellow card offence by the referee, but for which Chelsea manager Sonia Bompastor was sent off for after remonstrating on the touchline. Afterwards, the Frenchwoman Bompastor revealed that Thompson had been left visibly distressed by the incident.
She was crying, yeah, because, again, like, she's trying her best on the pitch in both games, and I think at the end, clearly, yeah, that's not good enough. When you are playing football and someone pulls your hair, it's bad. So, of course, yeah, she was crying and emotional in that situation and disappointed about the result.
And we'll have more on the fallout from that match in the next hour of the programme. Meanwhile, Manchester United are out of the Champions League after Bayern Munich came from behind to win 2-1 on the night. And that tie 5-3 overall on aggregates. Elsewhere in football, Jermaine Defoe says he hopes he can be a trailblazer for black managers as he targets promotion with new club Woking. The former England striker was announced as the new boss of the National League side on Sunday, his first managerial role.
I think for me it was always the plan. Towards the back end of my career when I knew I wanted to go into coaching. But yeah, I'm delighted to be here, of course. Looking forward to the challenge. It's amazing to be involved and we'll see what happens.
And finally, Tiger Woods has turned down the opportunity to captain the US Ryder Cup team in 2027. The former world number one's decision comes after he announced he would step away from golf for a period to focus on his health and well-being. Woods was charged with driving under the influence and being involved in a car accident last week.
Mike, thanks very much. Let's now look ahead to tomorrow on Radio 4.
Screenshot is where we journey through the multiverse of the moving image.
I'm Eleni Jones.
And I'm Mark Kermode. Every week we agree on a subject to begin with and then go off on our own, sometimes very different directions.
Along the way, we're joined by a top-notch array of guests and experts to make sense of it all.
In the new series, we trace the evolution of teachers on screen.
Quite often cinema has this shared experience. There's something that happens in the classroom that will also happen while watching a film.
We mark the 25th anniversary of Amélie's Paris. And as Mel Brooks turns 100, ask what spoofs still mean today.
The new series of Screenshot.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sound, starting tomorrow night at 7.15.
Time now, 26 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Nick Robinson. And Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
For the first time in more than 50 years, a rocket carrying astronauts is on its way to the moon. The crew of Artemis 2 blasted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida, attempting to go further into space than anyone has gone before. The astronauts won't land on the moon, but will pass its far side. NASA is hopeful the trip will pave the way for a lunar landing in 2 years. President Trump has said the United States is on track to complete all of its objectives in the war with Iran shortly. Speaking at the White House, he said the US would hit Iran extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. Since his televised address, oil prices have risen by 7% to $107 a barrel. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, is due to hold a virtual meeting with foreign ministers from 35 countries today to discuss measures to restore freedom of navigation through the Strait of Hormuz. The United States will not be involved. The government has withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors in England. Sir Keir Starmer had given the Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, 48 hours to call off a 6-day strike due to start next week or face losing the training posts. Black boxes which monitor a person's driving will be fitted to all new Motability vehicles driven by someone under the age of 30. The scheme allows disabled people to use their mobility allowance to lease a new car. Those running it say the change will keep insurance costs down after some tax breaks were removed in the last budget. But disabled people have said they worry it will affect their independence. Ministers have set out new rules to protect consumers from so-called subscription traps. Companies will have to make it easier to cancel subscriptions and give customers a cooling-off period. The government says the changes will save people an average of £170 a year for each unwanted subscription.
Jane, thank you very much. It's happened. The historic moon mission, NASA's Artemis 2 mission, has successfully, thankfully, blasted off from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. You may have stayed up for it, with all initial stages going to plan. 4 astronauts blasted off on the first crewed flight to the moon in more than 50 years. Palab Ghosh, our science correspondent, was at the launch in Florida. Palab, hello.
Hello. It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing.
I was going to say, describe, tell us more. What are the feelings? And you know, people waking up to this, first of all, some good news. You know, even if they weren't thinking about it yesterday, they're thinking about it now, aren't they?
They are. It's certainly hit the headlines. This is something that we haven't done for more than 50 years. I'm at the Kennedy Space Center as we speak, right in front of the countdown clock, the big vehicle assembly building to my left. It's dark. It's in the early hours of the morning, but just a few hours ago, it was electric. It was absolutely stunning. The gigantic rocket was 3 miles away, but it still seemed huge. And then when the countdown happened, we were all worried that it may not happen because of various issues that had arisen during the day. But then it did. There was a flash of light at the bottom, and then the entire rocket seemed to be engulfed in a white flame. Such was the brightness of the blast off. And then it rose almost like an angel, a bright angel rising into the sky. And the noise just grew louder and louder, deafening. We could hardly hear ourselves speak. You could almost feel the force of it against your chest. And then it rode off out into orbit. It was just a wonderful sight. I mean, everyone was quite giddy and high I have to say, just from that whole experience.
I bet. And just at the heart of it, you know, these four explorers.
Well, that's right. That's what makes the difference. There have been lots of launches here before. I've been lucky enough to see a few subtle launches. But the Kennedy Space Center was built to send astronauts to the moon, and it hasn't done that for such a long time. And as Jared Isaacman, the head of NASA, said at the news conference when the astronauts were in orbit, NASA is now back in business of sending people back to the moon. Now, there are a few hurdles yet to come. The astronauts are now orbiting the Earth, testing out their systems to see if the rocket's in good shape to make the final leg. I have to say that there were bits of it that were shaken, including the toilet, which isn't working properly. Other bits of the plumbing aren't so good, but that isn't going to stop them on its own. They're going to look at the computer systems, other parts of the system, and if everything is in good shape, in about 16 hours or so, it's going to make the final push to the moon. That's when the mission gets real, and we brace ourselves for some spectacular sights of both the Earth and the moon, sights that we've not seen for more than 50 years.
We're going to keep talking about this and getting insights, putting this into historical context and thinking about those astronauts and what they've gone through and what they're potentially going through now. But, it, you know, just hearing you describe it and hearing some of those clips from before, and we'll play more throughout the programme, you already hear the film being written because we're so used to, in some ways, aren't we, Palab, the sort of, you know, the storytelling side of this as well. Palab Ghosh there, science correspondent who was at the launch and still is in Florida. Thank you.
You could hear the excitement in his voice, couldn't you? And if you look, there's a lovely clip of our science editor, Rebecca Morrell, which is online at the moment, describing it as spectacular and barely being able to contain her excitement as she watched the launch just behind her. Let us turn, though, at 20 to 7, briefly at least, to some other news. They said they'd do it, and they have. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has withdrawn the government's plan to create 1,000 extra training places for junior or resident doctors in England after the BMA refused to cancel next week's planned strikes. Nick Triggle, our health correspondent, can tell us what's going on. They're playing hardball, Nick.
They are. I mean, it was on Monday evening the Prime Minister set that 48-hour deadline for the strikes to be called off, or resident doctors would lose these training posts. There has been some contact and discussions in the last 2 days, but sure enough, last night, with the BMA not cancelling the strikes, the government released a statement saying it wasn't operationally or financially possible to keep that package. They're pointing out that the strikes cost money, maybe £250 to £300 million. That is money that could have been spent on those speciality training posts that doctors move into at year after year two of their training. They're pointing out that the union, and these are pretty strong words, can't bank what's on offer and then keep striking. They're saying that's not how negotiations work. But they're arguing that this is not a cut to the doctor workforce, because what they had planned to do is convert locally employed doctors. These are sort of short-term posts that resident doctors tend to fill when they can't get training posts. And they were planning to convert those into these training posts. So it's not actually a cut in overall numbers of doctors, but there'll just be fewer training opportunities than there would have been.
Now, we had the chair of the Resident Doctors Committee of the BMA, another trade union representative, Dr. Jack Fletcher, on the programme the other day, saying, look, we're willing to talk. There is a deal in sight on money. Is there any sign that the government will take up that offer?
Well, he said that talks have been constructive. They restarted in January and they lasted all the way through to late March until they broke down and the British Medical Association called that strike. There's real frustration in the BMA about the move by the government. The two sides seem really far apart this morning. The BMA say doctors are being used as a pawn and they need a credible offer. They're claiming that the package that was put to them after those talks in January, February, March had been watered down at the last minute, particularly on how quickly pay progression was going to be achieved. That was alongside proposed covering of out-of-pocket expenses and these training posts we've been talking about. But at the heart of this is pay, and this is where the two sides are really still a long way from making a deal. The BMA wants to restore pay to 2008 levels, and despite pay rises totaling nearly 30% over the last 3 years, it's still, that BofA argues, 20% lower. Now, that's using a measure of inflation, RPI, that's higher than others. But the BMA counters this is the one, after all, used by the government to add interest to student loans.
Nick Driggle, our health correspondent, thank you.
It's 17 minutes to seven. Last night, a highly anticipated presidential address. Donald Trump spoke to US citizens about the war and his plan to attack Iran, as he puts it, relentlessly over the next 2 to 3 weeks. But several key questions remain, despite the big speech. I've been speaking to our chief North America correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue.
There are a lot of questions, I think, after that speech. I mean, the speech really didn't make any news, to be honest. It was a sort of rehash. The way I saw it was a kind of copy and paste of a whole bunch of his social media posts over the last week or so, kind of, you know, hacked together and then done on television. So there were lots of threats, fresh threats to Iran. There was sort of reassurance or attempts to reassure the American public, saying, we've only been at this 32 days. Don't forget how long Vietnam went on, how long Iraq went on, how long the First World, Second World War went on. So, you know, what are you worried about, kind of thing. And then there was really these omissions. So no mention, as we were expecting, of a fresh attack on NATO. That had been trailed significantly. This idea about how to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, which, you know, on the one moment he's saying to his allies, go and do it yourself. On the other time, he's saying Iran has to do it before we agree to a ceasefire. And now he's saying it will just happen, quote, naturally when the war is over. And of course, no mention of whether or not Israel is on board with his whole exit strategy, his off ramp from this war. So lots and lots of questions remaining.
Yeah, because, I mean, on that point, the attacks, of course, going in both directions still. But the point around Israel, with it being Passover yesterday and, you know, attacks happening just as that was beginning, that festival.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just an hour before or two, there were lots of explosions and you know, casualties in Tel Aviv before this huge, significant, holy sort of festival for Israelis and Jews around the world. And that is an indication, if you like, that when the president says, you know, mission close to be accomplished, you know, we've destroyed their missiles, their ability to attack, it's still happening. Stuff is still getting through, not just to Israel, but also to Arab Gulf states in the region as well. So while the degradation may be significant, Iran still has some capacity. And we saw those dramatic pictures just a couple of days ago, didn't we, of that Kuwaiti oil tanker that was hit in Dubai, which had 2 million barrels of oil on board. Now, fortunately, that didn't catch fire, but can you imagine?
Just a word, Gary, if you can, on his approval ratings, Donald Trump's approval ratings in America. You know, is he also... He must be, as always, keeping an eye on that and how this is impacting that.
Yeah, he keeps an eye on a bunch of numbers. The markets are absolutely central to how he sees things always. And you'll see him post things just before market opening quite often to try and boost or allay fears or whatever. His approval ratings are sliding. They're still pretty strong among Republicans. This is a partisan war in that sense. You know, 3/4 of Republicans still support him. You know, 90% roughly, 9 out of 10 of the MAGA base still support him. And I was in Alabama over the weekend talking to Republicans, and you get this extraordinary thing, you know, among farmers. One farmer I was talking to who's been hit hugely by diesel price rises, fertilizer price rises, but still believes the president is doing the right thing, even though it's hitting him hard in the pocket.
Gary O'Donoghue, our chief North America correspondent, thank you.
It's now 12 minutes to seven. What can be done to stop food prices soaring as a result of the war in Iran and the Gulf? That was the focus of talks held yesterday between the Chancellor, the major supermarkets and the British Retail Consortium, the trade body. Their chief executive, Helen Dickinson, joins me on the line. Good morning to you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Nick.
What did you ask government to do?
Well, I think it was a really constructive meeting, and we had the chief executives and executives from across the food retail industry with the Chancellor and the Secretary of State for Food and the Environment. So it was an opportunity to assess the situation and share what they were seeing across supply chains. And while the conflict in the Middle East means that there definitely is some inflation and that is inevitable, there are some policy levers that government can pull that would mitigate some of those inflationary pressures. So what we committed to do, we shared a sort of menu of what those are and committed to working with government to consider them further in order to be able to support households across the country, because obviously this is a worrying time.
The list I've seen of ideas that are around essentially seem to me to be reversing a whole series of things designed to either make the country greener or to deal with public health, ending new labelling guidance, packaging taxes, deposit return schemes and so on. Isn't there a danger that we do something in the short term to keep prices down that has rather bad long-term consequences?
Well, the context in which we find ourselves is unprecedented, and I think a lot of these things we discussed, we talked about time-limited easements. This isn't about ending many of these policies. This is about delaying some cost increases that would have impacted businesses over the course of the next 12 to 18 months. And all of those would feed into the cost bases of both manufacturers, producers and retailers. And everything that the government is committed to do and retailers share the same objective is to keep prices as low as possible for customers. And we have a very competitive retail industry in this country, and one that has, you know, dealt with, you know, various crises over the course of the last sort of 5 or 6 years or so.
There may be really people listening to this programme and saying, hold on, supermarkets make vast profits. I know you always emphasise that there's intense competition and the margin that you make is relatively low, but the amount that a Tesco's or a Sainsbury's make is huge. If we're all having to tighten a belt, maybe the supermarkets and their shareholders will have to tighten theirs too.
Well, I think what we've seen is a reduction in the profitability of many of these businesses. They're making sort of 2, 3, 4 pence in the pound. And there's been investigations. The Competition and Markets Authority has been very clear over the last 3 or 4 years when they've looked at this, that food inflation and the competition is very strong across the industry.
But Tesco's, I think, made £3 billion last year.
On sales of tens of billions, so you know, a profit margin that is low. And I think what's really important is we are the particularly energy costs. There is a big spike that many are seeing that will impact, you know, the cost of production, the cost of farming, the cost of transportation, and ripple eventually right through the supply chain. So what the government can do to mitigate that is really important.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Helen Dickinson there of the British Retail Consortium.
It's 9 minutes to 7. Something potentially important launches today, but its very existence is also a tragic sign of the times we live in here in the UK. I'm talking about the National Crime Centre, National Knife Crime Centre, I must say. That's a key word. It's led by Stephen Clayman, a commander in the Metropolitan Police, who also serves as the National Police Chief's Counsel lead for knife crime. It's to be funded by the Home Office, this new National Knife Crime Centre, and is set to try to help to deliver the government's ambition to halve knife crime in 10 years. Commander Stephen Clayman joins us now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
The new centre, as I say, important, we hope, but regrettable.
Yes, it was born out of the review I did last year, commissioned by the previous Home Secretary, on online knife sales and the ease and of ability for young people, young adults particularly, to buy knives. So the centre is very much focused at the moment on tackling the supply, but it has a wider sort of reach in time to look at some of the other aspects of knife-related crime. But it's the supply that we're going to be talking about a lot when we launch later today.
And the objective, you say the focus on supply, the overall objective?
Well, the overall objective is to make it much harder for someone to get hold of a knife. And we'll be demonstrating today regrettably, how easy it is to buy knives through social media channels, through websites, international websites, which are still selling prohibited weapons that are banned in the UK. You can still buy them through these sellers. We've been operating in a sort of a pilot for the last 6-7 months. We've already identified and closed down, 134 sellers. And 150 channels closed down because some of them have more than one channel.
If you go to one of those sellers and you've managed to not allow that to happen, shall we put it like that, do you have any understanding of what then happens, to that person trying to get...
Well, of course, the thing I should say, this is one element of dealing with knife crime, because knife-related crime, the most important and fundamental thing is understanding why someone seeks to choose to
do
pick
it
up
in
a
first
knife.
Place.
That will always be front and centre of what the police does, what partners do. This is an element that the review highlighted.
Ronan's Law, yes. Can you remind us of the law and the story behind that?
Yes, well, this is the story of Ronan Kander, who was tragically murdered as a teenager, and his killers purchased their weapons online. Their ID was fake. They picked it up in a post office without sufficient ID, wearing face coverings, and they were allowed to take those weapons, which were then used that day to kill, murder Ronan. It's a tragic story, and Pooja will be, and Nikita Kander, at the event today, and Nikita will be speaking, just reminding everyone that the backdrop of everything we're doing in relation to the centre was born out of Ronan's story, other stories of murder where killers have got hold of their knives, and they're not just... These knives that killed Ronan were not kitchen knives. They were ninja swords.
You were talking there about his family, who'll be talking. I suppose National Knife Crime Centre.
Yeah.
Some of our listeners may be thinking, do we need a centre? You know, you are the lead in this area as I said, they're around the National Police Chiefs Council, but there's lots of other agencies. Yeah. Why a new centre?
Well, actually, what the review pointed out was that you'd need to pull and coordinate what's happening across the system, the retail networks, the industry, the social media channels who have that content on their channels. We need to be doing something about removing that content.
So are we to take the fact that we have a centre, even though there's reason for it, and the report has produced that reason, and it's been accepted by two different governments?
Yeah.
Is it a damning indictment, really, on where we are?
Well, I think it's just a step forward in terms of just making sure we're more cohesive in the way that we deal with knife-related crime.
And on that, just in your role as a senior member of the Metropolitan Police, a question on something that happened in Clapham, South London earlier this week. 6 teenage girls have been arrested after 2 separate incidents of antisocial behaviour, we're told fuelled by online trends. This is in South West London. That's what the Metropolitan Police have said. What is happening? Can you tell us anything about that? What is the Metropolitan Police doing about it?
So I don't have too much detail on what I do know is that the police have already said they're closely monitoring the resources they've got ready to respond. You mentioned the online nature. That's something that we've always recognised. And this is another reason, as I say, why the centre's here, is because we need to look at the content. We need to be working with social media. There's a lot of focus, I know, on social media and tech, but that focus should be sustained. And we have a good operational relationship, but we need to make sure that they listen till they stop this content.
I know you can't go into the specifics, but it was a really shocking case in terms of what details are out there. That's why I've raised it. It's only just happened. And not least, as you say, that link between being driven by online into the real world. And that, I suppose, that how much are you seeing of that?
Well, I think it's the speed of transmission with social media and online content. If you look at 20 years ago, we had BlackBerry messaging was just arriving. Now things are quick. You've got audio and visual. We're just very focused. I know policing as a whole is really focused on being quick to respond. But of course, you also rely on some members of the public telling you, because we may not see those channels.
No.
Other people will need to advise police when they see something disturbing or beginning to develop.
Commander Stephen Clayman, now with the National Knife Crime Centre being launched today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, watching and listening to Artemis for fascinating moments, including the fact that I've just heard on their commentary, used comfort garments have been sent to the waste management system. That's what they told Houston in the last few minutes. We'll bring you the more important bits coming up. But it is also time to look ahead to a special weekend here on Radio 4.
Bold, silly, daring, unpredictable.
Celebrating Stop Art on BBC Radio 4.
My mind was made up.
I see your point.
It seemed the easiest thing to do.
Well then, don't procrastinate.
Drama from across the career of the playwright Sir Tom Stoppard.
Everything's upside down in the camp. It's as if you're either mad or the world is.
Alongside documentaries with insight from those who knew him.
One of the most experimental, innovative playwrights.
He needed the audience to complete that experience.
Celebrating Stoppard this Saturday, Sunday and Monday on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Looking forward to that. First now, though, let's get the weather with Ben Rich.
Thanks very much, Emma. Morning to you. A lot of dry weather around across the UK today. Best of the sunshine to be found across England and Wales. We will see some cloud and rain into Northern Ireland and Western Scotland later on. But starting across England and Wales, we do have a few showers around right now across the east coast of England, but they should fade quite quickly. And then we're looking at long spells of sunshine, just a bit of patchy cloud here and there, and the small chance of a light shower again into the afternoon, but most places will be dry. Best of the sunshine down towards the far southwest. For Northern Ireland, for southwest Scotland and for northern Scotland, a cold start here. We will see some sunny spells through the morning, but cloud spreading from the west, bringing some outbreaks of rain into the afternoon with a strengthening wind. Eastern Scotland, we should hold on to some dry weather and some sunny spells for much of the day. Temperatures north to south around 8 to 12 degrees. A bit of everything over the Easter weekend, looking very mixed, but particularly windy on Saturday night.
Thank you very much indeed, Ben. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Nick Robinson.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 2nd of April. The headlines, and what a headline to start with. NASA's Artemis 2 mission has blasted off on the first crewed voyage to the moon for over half a century. We will bring you the very latest, and at the heart of that story, four astronauts doing what we haven't done for a long time. President Trump has delivered a televised address saying the objectives of his war on Iran are nearing completion. Since he spoke, oil prices have surged and the government has withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 more training posts for doctors in England after they refused to call off a 6-day strike.
Coming up in the next hour, we'll keep watching and listening to the progress of Artemis 2 and bring you analysis of what it all means and what is going to happen next. And one of America's best-known generals' response to President Trump's overnight speech on Iran.
And what he's trying to say to the Iranians is, look, you're not hurting the United States by this because we don't need your oil. So I think that's more diplomatic language and an effort to bargain with them.
Former Foreign Secretary David Miliband speaks to us from Lebanon, the other fresh conflict in the Middle East.
The Israeli army occupied southern Lebanon for 18 years between 1982 and 2000. It was very bloody on all sides. And the fear is that we're going back into a long cycle with no good choices.
And the blind runner who's being guided round the Brighton Marathon by a bunch of assistants watching online half a world away. That's all after the BBC News read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
NASA's first mission carrying astronauts to the moon in more than 50 years has blasted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. Artemis 2 is due to take the crew further into space than anyone has gone before. The astronauts won't land on the moon but will pass its far side on a mission which NASA hopes will pave the way for a lunar landing in 2 years' time. Our science editor Rebecca Morell was watching the launch in Florida.
3, 2, 1, booster ignition and liftoff.
Wow! Oh my goodness! That is spectacular! It's not just what you see and you hear as the rocket lifts off. You can actually feel the force of it through your body. This is the most powerful rocket that NASA has ever built. Oh, wow. And it needs to be, because it's taking astronauts a quarter of a million miles away to the moon.
As the four astronauts headed skywards, leaving a plume of white smoke behind, the Artemis 2 commander, Reid Wiseman, spoke to Mission Control.
Houston Integrity, good last jettison, great view.
These are the first humans to head to the moon since 1972. Their first day will be spent in high orbit around the Earth, where they're checking out their spacecraft. A few issues with a brief loss of communications and the toilets have been identified, but nothing too serious so far. But if all looks okay, the go-ahead will be given for a blast of their main engine so they can begin their journey to the moon. During their 10-day mission, they'll be passing around its far side, the side we never see from Earth, before heading home and splashing down in the Pacific Ocean. This is a significant moment for NASA. Artemis 2 will pave the way for a lunar landing scheduled for 2028 and, eventually, a moon base.
President Trump has said the United States is getting very close to completing its military objectives in Iran. In a televised address from the White House, Mr. Trump said there would be a further 2 to 3 weeks of extremely hard strikes against Tehran. Since his speech, oil prices have risen by 7% to $107 a barrel. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman was listening.
This appeared to be President Trump's mission nearly accomplished moment, but with the extraordinary caveat that Iran's grip over oil transit through the Strait of Hormuz was essentially not America's problem. While he said the US would help, he reiterated his demand that countries who rely on the Strait for their energy supplies should take the lead in reopening it.
Build up some delayed courage, should have done it before, should have done it with us, as we asked. Go to the Strait and just take it. Protect it. Use it for yourselves. Iran has been essentially decimated. The hard part is done, so it should be easy. And in any event, when this conflict is over, the strait will open up naturally.
Mr. Trump suggested the U.S. could wrap up its military operations soon, but in the meantime, he threatened overwhelming destruction.
We are on track to complete all of America's military objectives shortly, very shortly. We're going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong.
Despite saying Iran had been crushed militarily, Mr. Trump still demanded that it do a deal with the United States without setting out anything about the terms. He once again vowed that if it didn't, the US would bomb all of Iran's power plants.
One Democratic senator said anyone watching the speech would have had no idea whether the president was escalating or de-escalating the war. With his assessment, here's our chief North America correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue.
This speech was largely a rehash of what President Trump has been saying for days. Copy and paste his social media posts over the last week or so, and you'd get last night's address to the nation. There were also a number of glaring omissions, which leave a plethora of questions unanswered. First, Israel. Does Benjamin Netanyahu's government agree with this timetable? We just don't know. Second, what happened to the idea of retrieving the hundreds of kilos of enriched uranium buried under rubble from last year's 12-day war? Third, what is the president's settled view on the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz? Now he says it would reopen naturally when the war is over. And finally, is he serious about pulling out of NATO? The truth is that after 20 minutes of a national address, we're really none the wiser about what victory in this war looks like. And given the often conflicting nature of the president's views from one day to the next, everything could change at any time.
The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, is due to host a virtual meeting of 35 foreign ministers today to discuss diplomatic measures that could be taken to restore freedom of navigation through the Strait of Hormuz. The United States won't be involved. The motoring organisation, the RAC, has said there were record monthly rises in the prices of petrol and diesel in the UK in March, with petrol up by 20 pence a litre and diesel 40 pence. The government has withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors in England. The Prime Minister had given the Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, 48 hours to call off a six-day strike due to start next Tuesday or face losing the training posts. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
A pay and jobs deal offered by the government to the BMA included a commitment to create 1,000 more training posts this year for newly qualified doctors to progress in their careers. With a lot more applicants than places last year, the BMA said some doctors were facing unemployment. The Department of Health said because the BMA had not agreed to call off the strike and put the offer to members, it wasn't possible for the system to deliver the new training posts and manage the NHS safely during strike action. The BMA said it had consistently maintained that industrial action could be postponed if there was a genuinely credible offer. Neither side has formally walked away from talks, though the possibility of any further negotiations before the strike looks remote.
It's understood the BBC decided to sack the Radio 2 presenter Scott Mills after learning that allegations of historical sexual offences had involved a boy under 16. The police investigation was closed in 2019 because prosecutors decided there was insufficient evidence to bring charges. The BBC said yesterday it had been made aware of the investigation in 2017, but new information had come to light in recent weeks. Scott Mills said he had fully cooperated with the police. The Conservatives have said they would scrap taxes on carbon, which are levied on British industry, if they were in government. Critics say such a move would cost the Treasury billions of pounds. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says carbon taxes are driving deindustrialisation and she would axe them. Her party argues the levies place a heavy burden on energy-intensive industries, such as manufacturing or the chemicals and refining businesses, where costs can reach tens of millions of pounds a year. But as well as encouraging companies to shift to less polluting practices, the taxes also currently raise around £4 billion annually for the Treasury. Critics warn that UK exporters would still face carbon charges from the EU, meaning some of that money would in effect shift abroad rather than disappear. The government said the policy would hammer industry and leave working people picking up the bill.
New rules to make it easier to cancel subscriptions have been announced by the government. From early next year, consumers will be given a 14-day cooling-off period after the end of a trial period or when an annual subscription renews automatically. Ministers say the changes could save the average person nearly £170 a year for every unwanted subscription.
Jane, thank you very much. It's 9 minutes past seven. It happened. NASA's launch of Artemis II, the historic moon mission, was a success. There are now, get your head around this, you may be watching the live feed, we certainly are, four astronauts on their way to the moon for the first time in more than half a century.
Launch weather is go.
We are going for all humanity. All right, Charlie, your Artemis 2 crew is go for launch.
On this historic mission, you take with you the heart of this Artemis team, the daring spirit of the American people, and the hopes and dreams of a new generation.
The rocket is on its own. Four brave explorers ready to ride the most powerful rocket NASA has ever launched. 10, 9, 8, 7, RS-25 engines lit. 4, 3, 2, 1, booster ignition and liftoff. The crew of Artemis II, now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
If it sounds like a film, I know what you're feeling and thinking. A few hours into their flight, it's reality, though. The crew gave this update from the Orion capsule.
Right now, myself and Christina are in seats 1 and 2, getting ready for rendezvous and ProxOps demonstration. Victor's just finished up getting out of suits and getting suit drying going, and Jeremy is hard at work in cabin configuration. It was an amazing ride uphill. The views, we've got two moon rises that we've had so far, and the views of planet Earth, we've circled it completely, and we forgot how beautiful it is to look down on Earth.
And we're listening to the live comms between the Artemis crew in Houston. NASA has just given this update.
The crew is getting into the end of their day, a very long day for our astronauts. They are officially in their pre-sleep period, working through that checklist, and will soon be moving into the sleep portion of their day.
I absolutely love the idea of pre-sleep, which we're going to get onto. But before we do, let's not talk about sleep. Let's talk about liftoff. Professor Kevin Fong is going to be with us throughout the programme and was here yesterday, aerospace professor at UCL, host of 16 Sunsets podcast about the history of NASA's space shuttle programme. And he used to work with NASA on human spaceflight. He's actually also a doctor. But you wanted to go up there. Kevin, I mean, your face when you heard that, just it's quite emotional, isn't it?
It's really emotional. I've seen three shuttles go, and when you hear the countdown, it just brings it all back, and the excitement and the anticipation. But you know what was really surprising last night is as I realised they were going to go, as it got into the terminal, you know, the last 10 seconds, I was just really nervous, because that's, you're conditioned to think like that for the first 2 minutes when those solid rockets are going. It is just terror. And I used to remember watching it at the Cape with the medical crews when we were out there. Everyone who knew what they were watching held their breath for 2 minutes as it went, but it went beautifully. It was amazing to watch it.
We did list it out a little bit earlier in the programme, right at the start, that there were a couple of glitches just before, and people saying, and I remember yesterday we spoke about clouds.
Yeah.
They obviously cleared off.
But so many things have to come together for this to work. And as it was coming quite close to it, you had a problem with the launch abort system, pretty critical system to go wrong. And then they had a battery error and a sensor error. And I thought, this is too close. They're going to pull it. Because you're so used to them having to postpone that when you go, oh my gosh, no, we are going to go. It's a bit of a shock.
And I just mentioned there, you know, you can be watching the feed, and many people will be doing NASA's Artemis 2 live mission coverage. There's an official broadcast. And it's actually largely a static screen with some white words coming up and various updates, although there's these miles from Earth is getting updated all the time, which is very exciting. Yes, just to get your head around. Pre-sleep. Can you talk to us about pre-sleep? Hanging up your sleeping bag so it doesn't float away?
Everything on their schedule, they've got this really detailed schedule, happens, you know, according to a rhythm, and they do a checklist to make sure that everything goes by the numbers. So it's an exhausting day for them. They've been going for quite a long time, and, you know, this has been, they wake up, they've got suited up, they've driven out to the pad, they're now in space, they've done quite a lot of shaking the vehicle down. So now it's time for pre-sleep, so which means, you know, they're winding down, they're doing the things they need to do to get themselves ready for sleep. It's not straightforward going to sleep up there. You've got to strap yourself into a sleeping bag, Velcro yourself to the wall. My favourite story about sleeping in space is, you know, if you fall asleep, you've got a boring mate, the thing that wakes you up is gravity, because your head sort of nods off. That doesn't happen in space. So if you have a boring friend in space, eventually someone stops talking and you look around and they're sort of floating around asleep in space, and you kind of just gently chuck them in their sleeping bag.
Love that. Well, pre-sleep happening at the moment on the tight schedule. Whether they'll be able to get to sleep, that's a whole other thing. What a day. You're coming back to talk to us very shortly, Professor Kevin Fong. Thank you.
Look forward to that. It's 7:15 now. Overnight, Donald Trump tried to reassure American consumers that the war with Iran was a success and wouldn't last much longer. The markets weren't impressed, though. The price of oil went up again, meaning higher prices for us all. The Conservatives say they've got an answer to the increased cost of power, which is to scrap green taxes, save businesses money. From those costs that have been loaded up, they say, by the Treasury. We're joined by the Shadow Secretary of State for Energy Security and Net Zero, Claire Katina. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
You're calling it a cheap power plan. What taxes would you scrap, and who would pay for the money lost to the Treasury?
So we have in our cheap power plan a plan which would cut the average household bill by £200 and the average electricity bill for business by 20%. And that's by scrapping particularly carbon taxes and also some of the old outdated wind subsidies, which we think are now too expensive for the system. And it wouldn't cost taxpayers a penny. That's the crucial difference between us and Labour. It would help everybody and it wouldn't put a burden on the taxpayer.
Well, they took crucial claims. Let me jump in there, because they are saying, the Treasury and Labour Party, hold on, there's £4 billion raised by putting tax on carbon, the so-called UK emissions trading scheme and carbon price support. So where's that money come from?
So you would get a mix of the money from scrapping wind subsidies. At the moment, there's about £2.6 billion that the taxpayer is paying for these outdated wind subsidies that I talked about. You'd also get another £800 million from scrapping heat pump subsidies, and then something like Great British Energy, for example, the money that isn't reducing household bills, it isn't being spent on nuclear, we would take some of those costs out of the system as well. So what we've done is we've looked very carefully to make sure that our plan is fully funded, because what we don't want to do is go back to the hard-pressed taxpayer. And if I could just explain it, one of the things that I think is particularly egregious about the carbon tax on electricity generation is not only is that pushing up the prices for people, but it has an effect right across your system. So when the Treasury raises £2 billion from carbon taxes on your electricity generation, it actually costs the system much more, £7 billion. And more than that, what you're seeing is that the carbon tax on industry is driving industry out of business.
Okay, let me just pick up a point, though, that the industry themselves raise. Their concern is that there are carbon taxes. These were meant to ensure that business had incentives to produce cleaner, greener products. The problem they argue is, look, there are carbon taxes all over the world, not least with our principal trading partner, Europe. And so the lobbying organisation Energy UK says, if you take those carbon taxes off British goods, the EU will just load them back on and they'd be paid for at the point of import.
So let me just come on 2 points on that, which I think are very important. What you're seeing in this country is that the carbon taxes, you're right, they were meant to make people decarbonize, but instead factories are shutting down. We lost a third of our refineries last year. We've lost 60% of our chemical capacity over the last 4 years. These companies are not decarbonizing. They are simply unable to compete on the global stage. And you talked about carbon taxes and where they are in the world. They're not in the US, they're not in the Middle East, they're not in Asia. You know, countries around the world have simply not followed suit in the way that
but the
we point thought
about
they
the EU?
Would. So so to your point to the EU, yes, you would pay an adjustment at the border. About £800 million over the next 5 years is what the government assesses. That is far outweighed by the billions of pounds you're losing from industry because these factories are shutting down.
Just final quick
and
one if we
could.
Could
just make
our
one key point.
Yeah.
All you are doing is you're shutting down British industry, which is much cleaner than the rest of the world.
And
you're importing dirtier imports from countries which do not face those carbon
taxes. Forgive
me,
Rush, at your time, a bit short on a busy news day. So I just simply wanted to give you the chance to address the rather obvious point. You guys brought these carbon taxes in. In fact, it was Kemi Badenoch, your leader, as a Treasury Minister, who brought some of these carbon taxes in. So you putting your hands up and saying, sorry, we got it wrong.
Well, we've done that across net zero, as you know, Nick. And I think in opposition, it's incumbent to not shy away from the things that you think are now policies which are wrong. And if you look at refineries, being less able to produce your own jet fuel, petrol, diesel, it is simply lunacy in a world where we're going into yet another series of supply shocks. We have to be able to make things in Britain. And that's why we think you have to axe the carbon tax to save British industry.
Claire Coutinho, Shadow Secretary of State for Energy Security and Net Zero. Thanks for joining us.
20 past seven, sticking with some of that. Petrol and diesel prices have jumped more than in any previous month. Sean Farrington is back. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, this is according to the RAC. Follows a year where many car makers have scaled back their electric vehicle strategies, actually. Stellantis being one, Peugeot, Vauxhall. It's got the Electric Leap Motor brand as well under its watch. And it has said the number of people wanting EVs had been overestimated. Well, I've got Leap Motors UK Managing Director with us, Damien Daly. Damien, good morning. Thank
good
you
morning.
For your time. Given customer reaction in recent weeks since this war began in Iran, do you now reflect that it might have been a mistake for Stellantis to focus more on petrol and diesel?
I think fundamentally, Sean, it's important that Stellantis, probably more so than any other car maker, has made significant investments in this area. If you look at the grants which are available, over 50% of the cars which are available through the EV grant are Stellantis products. So this shows the investment we've made in this area.
But there's definitely been a step away from it. I mean, very, very vocal about it, your chief executive overall.
Yeah, but it's still really, really important. And at the end of the day, the destination of going electric is there. If anything, it's more about the trajectory, because if you look at it now today, yesterday, 22%, the ZEV mandate, the zero emission mandate, which is a target we're given as manufacturers, we should be at 33. And within a heartbeat of 24 months, that's jumping over to 50% and eventually 80 and 100. So we're fully on board with the direction everything's going. The bigger issue really is the trajectory, and you know the climb is going to be big. Elite Motor, just to be clear, we're 100% battery electric vehicle, so we've got an offering. Price has been a factor in the past.
Well, yeah, that's why it's interesting what you will have seen in the last few weeks. Have you seen people, because of the war in Iran, inquire more, make purchases for electric vehicles than you would have expected?
Well, I think most people who are coming to replace their vehicle now are thinking, is my next car going to be electric?
Well, that's not what Stellantis overall were saying. They've overestimated the number of people doing that. I just wonder, in the last few weeks, just given what we've seen with oil prices.
Well, we've seen at Leap Motor, I mean, basically last month, we had our biggest month ever in terms of registrations. We also had our biggest month ever in terms of order take. And to take your point about the war, and I think it's probably a combination of a number of things, but obviously petrol price being one of them. If I look at our inquiries and our website visits, we're up 65% versus Q4. So there's definitely, from our perspective, been a leaning towards more electric vehicles.
And so how does that play out with your ability to, you know, deliver them in the coming months? Are there any supply chain questions, partly because of the war, partly because of the ramped up demand? We've heard a bit of this in the world of heat pumps and solar panels.
So at the moment, we've not experienced that. So, I mean, we're selling to a customer who wants the best value product. So they tend to want cars quite quickly. So we carry a number of stock on the ground. So we've not experienced that yet. But I think fundamentally, all these points about the electric, I think most people want to make that jump. Price has been an issue in the past. We're offering the best value, in fact, the lowest cost of EV in the market at Leapmotor. Well, and I think this was what an enabler for us.
Damien Daly, thank you very much for your time. Leapmotor's UK Managing Director.
Thank you.
Sean, thank you. 23 minutes past seven. The thought of running the marathon is daunting enough. Imagine doing it if you're blind. Over the years, a few brave souls have, by being tethered to a sighted runner. We're joined now, though, by a man who's going to rely on smart specs that allow volunteers watching on screens to be his guide on the route. Clark Reynolds is a Braille artist known professionally as Mr. Dot. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Sounds intriguing. How does it work?
It's amazing. The technology of the past couple of years for the blind community has taken leap and bounds. Obviously, the rocket launch today it is literally changing our lives. We're pushing the boundaries of what vision impairment is through technology, and the app is more of a human story. It's not AI. AI is the glasses that allow the app to be a platform, but it's more of a human story.
Back to the fundamentals, if you would. You put on a pair of glasses with cameras built in, and those cameras are fed online. So what are you hearing in your ears, and who is it that's talking to you?
It's complete strangers. So I say the magic words. I say, hey, Meta, call me my eyes. And I, within about, 30 seconds, I will get a complete stranger. I have no idea who they are, from around the world, literally. And we have a bit of discussion. I say what I'm about to do. And they said, oh, yeah, please, we'll be on board. And for 5 minutes, we talk. And they say if there's a bin or a parked car or a person. And majority of the time, it is about a conversation about what is sight loss.
Just to really get it down to nuts and bolts, they're monitoring the image through the camera on your glasses, and they can see an obstacle. What and say, you know, swerve to the left, go to the right.
Yes. Yeah, it's like you know when you have those Peloton bikes and you've got someone guiding you on a video screen. They say, oh yeah, let's go with me, go with me. It's like that. It's just that I'm the Peloton, and they're the virtual reality. And I always say, I'm getting your steps in for you today.
So they're not only being your eyes, they're also being cheerleaders as well. They're supporting you.
Yes, so much. That is what I've found out in the last 10 months doing this, is the human stories. It's the connections, you know, and it's a different the lingo. You know, if I've got someone from up north, if they say a bin, they say it's a wheelie bin. If I've got someone from America, they say it's a garbage bin.
Yeah.
And that's great, isn't it?
Clark, well, it all sounds fascinating. Best of luck running the marathon with the help of those online cheerleaders.
Well, it's 26 minutes past seven. We'll keep the physical pursuit, shall we, Mike, sir?
That is remarkable, though. Good luck to Clark. As someone who's training for the London Marathon myself, my first ever one later this month. That is really
inspiring.
I have
been waiting for you to mention it.
Yeah, I haven't mentioned it, have I?
No.
I haven't dropped it in.
The emails for sponsorship, everything.
Yes, I have sent the...
unnoticed.
The begging emails around, yeah. But plenty more of them to come between now and the next 4 weeks and the marathon day at the end of April. Now, though, let's talk about football, because we can get more on the fallout from that all-English quarterfinal in the Women's Champions League. Arsenal losing to Chelsea 1-0 on the night, but winning the tie overall 3-2 on aggregate. So the holders through to the semi-finals, but all the focus this morning is on a flashpoint at Stamford Bridge right at the end of the match.
Katie McCabe, no foul. That is curious. Well,
yeah, it's a hair pull. It's a hair pull.
Yes, controversy right at the end of the match at Stamford Bridge last night. Delighted to say that we can speak to the former Arsenal and Chelsea goalkeeper, Siobhan Chamberlain, who was following the match. Hi, Siobhan.
Good morning.
That was the big flashpoint, wasn't it? That hair pull by Katie McCabe on Alyssa Thompson, certainly dominating the post-match coverage. And Sonia Bompastor, the Chelsea manager, has a right to feel aggrieved, doesn't she? I mean, many people surprised that that wasn't a yellow card offence, at least.
Look, I think you're going to give it any card, it's going to be a red. I think the referees obviously decided that whether it wasn't intentional, whether she didn't see it, whether she didn't need to check it, but I think we've seen previously, if people get seen pulling hair, it's a red card. I think if it had been a yellow, I think there'd have still been complaints as to why it wasn't a red. I think Katie McCabe's later come out on her social media and said that she didn't mean to pull her hair, she meant to pull her shirt. Which, does there need to be intent for it to be a card? Controversy, yes, very much so.
But if the referee didn't see it, Siobhan, isn't that the whole point of VAR? That's what the technology is there for the off-field assistants to advise the referee to go and review it.
Oh, 100%. And there's been so many cases of why hasn't VAR been used? And even in the leg last week, when Chelsea scored what looked like a fairly legitimate goal where Berman got up ahead and headed one in and it got disallowed. And everyone thought that when it went to VAR, the goal would be chalked back on, but it wasn't. So I can understand why Bombastor does feel slightly aggrieved, not just by the referees, but also probably by VAR.
Yeah, it was after the first leg last week at the Emirates, wasn't it, where she didn't mince her words, Bombastor, post-match, saying that the standard of refereeing in the women's game across the board was below the standard that she would expect. And again, after last night's incident, you would have to say that many would feel that she has a point.
Yeah, of course. And look, refereeing is hard. I mean, when I played, I was probably definitely one to criticise and to say, come on, you've got to get better decisions. But when you watch it and you expect them to make those decisions straight away on the spot after seeing it once, it's difficult. But that's why we've introduced VAR.
So Arsenal losing on the night, but progressing on aggregate to the last four. We don't know who they'll face in the semis yet, Siobhan, but how do you think they will fare? Are they still favourites, do you think, to defend their title?
It's going to be really interesting. It's not decided who they're going to play yet. Wolfsburg play Lyon tonight, but Arsenal will be very, very confident. Having beaten Chelsea over the two legs, they're holders of the trophy at the moment. They won't want to let anyone take that back from them. So it's an exciting time for Arsenal.
All right. Well, we await those semi-finals with interest. For now, though, Siobhan Chamberlain, thanks for speaking to us on the programme.
Thank you very much.
Meanwhile, Manchester United are out of the Women's Champions League after Bayern Munich came from behind to win 2-1 on the night, 5-3 on aggregate. And just to mark your card, in the next hour of the programme, we are talking cricket. We will preview the brand new County Championship season, which gets underway tomorrow. We have a special report from newly promoted Leicestershire, who are back in the First Division for the first time since 2003 and have to declare an interest. I am from Leicester, so this was a bit of a homecoming from me. Went up there early this week. Great to be back at Grace Road, everyone. Very excited to have the Foxes back in the big time.
Extraordinary. We pay you to do the job rather than the other way around, which is how it should be. Thanks for that. Look forward to it, Mike. What about the weather? Can we look forward to that? Well, a sunny start for many today. Cloud gradually increasing from the west. If you're in Northern Ireland and West Scotland, though, heavy rain and wind is coming.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4, where we're quite excited you can hear about that historic moon mission. We'll keep you up to date with it. You're listening to Nick Robinson and Emma Barnett. It's 7:30 and we've got a summary of the news from James Steele.
A rocket carrying astronauts is on its way to the moon for the first time in more than 50 years. The crew of the Artemis II mission blasted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. The spacecraft is now in orbit around the Earth. The astronauts won't land on the moon but will pass its far side. NASA is hopeful the trip will pave the way for a lunar landing in 2 years. President Trump has said the United States is on track to complete all of its objectives in the war with Iran shortly. Speaking at the White House, he said the US would hit Iran extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. Since his televised address, oil prices have risen by 7% to $107 a barrel. The Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper is due to hold a virtual meeting with 35 foreign ministers today to discuss how to restore freedom of navigation through the Strait of Hormuz. The US will not be involved. The government has withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors in England. Sir Keir Starmer had given the Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, 48 hours to call off a 6-day strike due to start next week or face losing the training posts. All new Motability vehicles used by someone under the age of 30 are to be fitted with black boxes which monitor a person's driving. The Motability scheme allows disabled people to lease a new car using their mobility allowance. Those running it say the change will keep insurance costs down after some tax breaks were removed in the last budget. Disabled people have said they're concerned it will affect their independence. Ministers have set out new rules to protect consumers from so-called subscription traps. Companies will have to make it easier to cancel subscriptions and give customers a cooling-off period. The government says the changes will save people an average of £170 a year for each unwanted subscription.
Jane, thank you very much. It's 28 minutes to eight now, and in a highly anticipated address last night, UK time, you could say President Trump's update on the war prompted more questions than answers. In a speech directed to US citizens, he vowed to attack Iran relentlessly, as he put it, over the coming 2 to 3 weeks, saying American forces were nearing completion of the war. But he did not say that US forces would go in on the ground. And is that a mistake? I started that point of inquiry with my conversation, with General Wesley Clark, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, and I asked for his military analysis of what the president had to say.
It sounds like he believes that the nuclear materials that were apparently in Isfahan have been further degraded or destroyed at this point based on the big explosions we've seen and so forth. The point is that he has reduced the ability of the Iranians to continue to build their missile forces and threaten. There still remains the issue of the Strait of Hormuz and getting oil flowing again to the world. And what he's trying to say to the Iranians is, look, you're not hurting the United States by this because we don't need your oil. So I think that's more diplomatic language and an effort to bargain with them.
How is this playing with Americans? This has obviously been a premiership based on America first and focusing on what is good for America.
Well, I think it's actually it's good for Europe and Asia, too, because I don't think in the modern world you want a state that has its sole mission in life to destroy another state. 47 years, the clock's been ticking. They've used assassinations, car bombs, truck bombs. They've killed numerous American soldiers, Marines, airmen. This is an aggressor state. The people in Iran are held hostage by the government. You know, they killed 30,000 of their own people who were demonstrating against the government back in January, and maybe more than that. And they're continuing a really harsh crackdown. This is a zealous theocratic regime whose purpose was in life, was and still is, to bring about the destruction of humanity and summon the 12th Mahdi back to Earth.
But has Iran held out more than you thought, in the sense of looking at this, you know, with all your experience of military command, you know, when Donald Trump, just bringing us back to what he's just said, when he says 2 to 3 weeks and not going in on the ground, is that then naive of Donald Trump to think that it can be done from the air in 2 to 3 weeks? Or realistically, is this going to keep going?
Well, we don't know. Obviously, he would like it to be done in 2 to 3 weeks, and he would like to have it done without ground forces. And we just don't know at this point. But remember, when I was NATO commander and we had to stop Serb ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, we did a graduated air campaign. We didn't start it with a bang the way this started. We started cautiously and slowly because that's the way the European political leadership wanted it. And it went for 11 weeks and people were asking the same questions. Mm. Oh, my goodness, when's it going to be over, this and that? And why are you bombing this and that? And what happened with this and that? I mean, it was a lot of the same questions. We're only 4.5 weeks into this.
So just then, you've mentioned NATO. Donald Trump didn't. And your view of, I suppose, that, you know, the alliance and where that is at the moment, what's your take?
Well, I think NATO is essential for the United States. And I think whatever he might have blurted out at some point, I think, you know, he recognizes that we're not going to pull out of NATO. We need NATO. It's in the United States' interest as well as Europe's interest. Europe is our major trading partner, our most important a direct investment partner, and stability in Europe is critical for the United States and our economy. So, I hope we're not pulling out, and that's why I didn't mention it. It's very difficult to rally popular support for something like this, because, first of all, every nation in Europe's a democracy. They've all got their own domestic issues. Many of them have populations that have significant minorities that might be sympathetic to the Iranians. you have Iranian influence in some of these countries, violent influence and threats in some cases. And so in some ways, President Trump has done NATO a favor. But this isn't over yet, and he may well come to NATO in the proper procedure and ask for help at some point. Right now, it probably there's not much NATO could have done anyway, except as Britain has been good enough to do, allow us to use air bases and so forth in Germany as well.
The sentiment towards Britain from Donald Trump has not been positive in recent days. How seriously do you think Keir Starmer, our Prime Minister, should take that?
That's a difficult question to answer. All I can tell you is that in terms of fundamental interests, the United States has fundamental interests, vital interests in the stability of Europe and obviously in UK. And I think Europe has those fundamental interests in its relationship with the United States. And as governments come and go over the last 70 years of NATO, we've always managed to find our way through the squabbles and upsetments and crises. NATO's had a number of them, and somehow we've all made it through, and I think we'll continue to do so.
General Wesley Clark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
21 minutes to 8 now. There's one thing you're going to hear again and again this morning. Excitement. Unalloyed joy from those watching the launch of Artemis 2. And even those who are paid to stay calm are getting in on the act. Just listen to the controllers in Houston and the crew.
3 minutes, 50 seconds into the flight of Artemis II, Wiseman, Glover, Cook, and Hansen cross the boundary to space with good comm checks.
And we have a beautiful moonrise. We're headed right at it.
We've been listening to the live communications between the crew inside the Orion spacecraft and Mission Control. Here's just some of the chatter to and from in the last hour, just before what's called pre-sleep.
You can go ahead and normalize Orion to Earth 2, and then we're just going to have a PCD question. I'm having a little bit of network issues. I need some troubleshooting assistance.
Copy. We will normalize.
As we are working on the Equus wall, we need new, fresh comfort garment stowage location for Christina and Jeremy. We're having a little bit of trouble finding their new comfort garments because we're going to stow them with the suits.
Copy. We will look that up and get back to you when we have it.
Listening to that. Trying to translate it for us is Kevin Fong, Professor of Public Engagement and Innovation at UCL, host of the 16 Sunsets podcast. What were they talking about there, Kevin?
Excellent question. So they've just got basically changed out of their launch and entry suits, and they're, you know, they're tidying away, they're packing away, and as far as I can tell,
yes, I can guess what a comfort. <That's right.
laughs> but they're working near the Equus, so the environmental control and life support system, yeah. There, and they're trying to find stowage for these. I think the comfort garments are these liquid cooling garments that they wear underneath the suits to keep themselves cool or right. Warm. Yeah. But they're basically trying to do some housekeeping, and they can't find the right drawer, as far as I
now,
can tell.
I know you're an expert. You may not know everything. Do you know what the PCD system is?
I'm not sure.
But this is, yeah, pre-sleep, we were saying. You were talking to Emma about it just a second ago, as they get ready for bed, which includes actually kind of shutting the blinds, doesn't it, in effect?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's pretty bright up there. And you're coming around, and depending on where you are in the orbit, the sun rises and falls, you know, up to 16 times a day as you're going around the Earth. It's going to be a little bit different for them because they're in a high orbit. But sleep is really important because, you know, the crew performance is important. In the days before the launch, they're sort of shifting their sleep to get onto the right pattern.
It must be incredibly hard. I mean, just the adrenaline flow.
Well, as soon as they got into orbit, almost, you know, once they've done the basic procedures, that they say, well, now you need to go to sleep. I just don't know anyone who's going to sleep. And it's a 4-hour sleep window or something like that. I wouldn't sleep up there. I don't really know that many people are going to sleep that well.
Now, they've got so much to concentrate on, they are probably not thinking of the historical significance. But I know you have been. I mean, you've got a child that you probably remember growing up being told about Apollo. Not everybody's excited by space, but do you think this actually will do something for the mood?
So I really hope so, because this is something new, right? This is people going out and flying by the moon and seeing it up close for the first time in over half a century. This is genuine excitement, genuine exploration. And you know, I hope it will do for this generation what it did for me, you know, because I grew up in the wake, really, of Apollo, understanding the excitement of it, understanding that this was an idea big enough for everyone to talk about, and this was where I wanted to point my life. I mean, it pointed me at science. I hope it will do it for a new generation.
And unlike most people listening, even most scientists, you actually tried.
Oh yeah.
You tried to be an astronaut.
I did indeed. I tried. Well, I tried in 2008, and then I tried again in 2021. I did okay, actually. There were 23,000 applicants, and bizarrely, I found myself down in the last 91 candidates. So it was close, but not close enough.
Yeah, well, we'll keep watching and listening. Professor Kevin Fung, I know you'll be back with us just in a short while. Thank you very much indeed.
17 minutes to 8 now, and we're going to be focusing on something a bit closer to home, much closer to home, another doctor's strike. The 15th in 3 years, it hurtles towards us over the Easter holidays. The government stuck to its guns and withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors, formerly known as junior doctors, in England. The Prime Minister had given the doctors' union 48 hours to call off the six-day strike. That's due to start next Tuesday or face this loss. And it's stuck to its guns. Hugh Pym, the BBC health editor, is here. Hugh, tell us more.
Well, that's right, Emma. They stuck to the guns that effectively they were putting out there on Monday, late on Monday, when an interview given by Sir Keir Starmer in The Times said it was going to be 48 hours for the resident doctors, the British Medical Association, to accept the offer, or at least put it to their members. And the 48 hours, in effect, expired late last night. So they've said they will withdraw this offer to create 1,000 training places. This is for newly qualified doctors, helping them get into career progression. There were 30,000 applicants for these posts last year, but only 10,000 available. The BMA said some doctors were facing unemployment. So training posts has been quite a big issue for the union and the government. The 1,000 were going to be starting to roll out from really now, but the government say they can't do that while there's a strike on. It's just too difficult to organise the process while trying to keep the NHS safe. The BMA say that this job situation shouldn't be linked to pay. It's a pay dispute. They think the government has not offered them enough to compensate for previous inflation. Now, theoretically, the talks haven't formally come to an end. They have been talking since Monday. They could get together today, but I think the clock is ticking. That seems highly unlikely. We then go into the bank holiday weekend, which is always really pressurised for the NHS with some other services closed, and then straight into the strike on Tuesday in England, as things look at the moment.
You know, those listening worried about this and how it will affect them, is it going to be similar to last time that there'll be a service? But, you know, I suppose I'm just trying to understand the impact this time. And have you got any inkling at all, Hugh, that the doctors may blink?
Well, I think the doctors blinking, it seems highly unlikely, because they called this strike after months of talks going right back to the last strike at the end of last year. So that seems very unlikely, but I would never rule out the possibility of some last-minute talks going through, maybe even the weekend. But the NHS is prepared for it. They've had 14 of these strikes before. They know how to run emergency departments. Consultants, senior doctors are put on the front door of A&E, and it sometimes works quite effectively with them there. But planned treatment, to a certain extent, is cancelled. But again, the NHS in England has managed to carry out, they say, 95% of operations and procedures in previous strikes, so they'll hope to do that again. But it's certainly not welcome, I suppose, for anybody that this dispute is continuing. And, of course, the consultants, the senior doctors, are having their own ballot on possible industrial action, and that ballot will run right through until the summer. So a challenge for the government in managing this, and in the NHS, patients and the BMA in its own way.
Hugh Pym, we'll keep following this, of course, the twists and turns. BBC Health Editor, thank you.
It's 13 minutes to 8. In a moment, we're going to be hearing from David Miliband, former Foreign Secretary, now leader of the humanitarian aid organisation, the International Rescue Committee, who's currently in Beirut. He's been seeing for himself the impact of the war in Lebanon and has a warning for us all that it could, if unresolved, cause famine in large parts of the world. But it's time now for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Mona Siddiqui, Professor of Religion and Society at King's College London.
Good morning. A little more than an hour before sunset, on Florida's Space Coast, thousands packed the beaches and causeways to look to the heavens to witness a launch of Artemis II, a fully crewed NASA rocket returning to the moon. The most powerful rocket ever built will not land on the moon, but its four astronauts will go on a 10-day journey that circles the moon, all in a spacecraft the size of a minibus. This is science and exploration, but underneath it is a history of human longing. For centuries, the moon has been a mirror of that desire, a silent witness to our questions, our hopes, and our audacity. As the American planetary scientist Carl Sagan wrote, reflecting on the Apollo moon landings in 1969, that for so long, the moon was a metaphor for the unattainable. But every space exploration is also a provocation. It asks whether human curiosity excuses human hubris, whether the thrill of discovery outweighs the suffering left behind with millions who still live in poverty and neglect, and an ecosystem which strains under our footprints. Artemis may inspire awe, but it also challenges us to confront our conscience. Can we pursue the sublime without fully honouring what we already hold? Perhaps our desire to seek new horizons, to test our own capabilities, is profoundly human, because seeking the heavens isn't arrogance if it awakens reflection. There's a kind of worship hidden in wonder itself. As the Quran reminds us, "And he has subjected for you the night and day, and the sun and moon, and the stars are subjected by his command. Indeed, in that are signs for people who reason." It isn't that the moon asks to be understood, or the stars compete to be seen, but we humans are restless and have a need to reach beyond ourselves. Exploration is an invitation which asks us to envision what humanity can become when curiosity is tempered with responsibility and ambition with conscience. And as for the majority of us who will only ever see the beauty of the moon from afar, we will continue to think of it not in the language of science and technology, but in poetry, romance, and longing. We borrow its light, a light that is not its own. It is our quiet companion in pain and solitude. And perhaps the most important thing the moon teaches us is how to live with humility and awe in a universe that feels both infinite yet intimately known.
That was Thought for the Day with Mona Siddiqui. It's 10 minutes to 8.
If Donald Trump's primetime address to the nation overnight on the progress of the war with Iran was designed in part to soothe financial markets, worried that no end to the war is in sight, it's already failed. Oil prices have gone up again. Stocks have fallen. And this morning comes a new warning of the consequences of one aspect of the war, the crucial aspect, the near closure of the global shipping route through the Strait of Hormuz. It comes from the chief executive of the global humanitarian organisation, the International Rescue Committee, former Foreign Secretary David Miliband, who's just been visiting Lebanon and Syria. We spoke as he was in Beirut Airport.
I think that the ripple effects of the Iran war are consuming the whole Middle East region. Every country is affected, and the most fragile countries, those trying to recover from conflict, like Syria, like Lebanon, which I visited, are in danger of being consumed in a really fatal and dangerous way. Just here in Lebanon, where I am, one quarter of the population, over a million people, have been displaced by the latest clashes over the last 4 weeks since Hezbollah sent rockets into Israel. Israel responded. And there's just mass displacement of people, over 1,000 people killed, including a former staff member of ours with her husband and three-year-old child. And the sense of fear and impending doom about the situation is very, very significant indeed. And next door in Syria, they're just desperate to stay out of the trouble. They're trying to rebuild themselves, but the danger is they get sucked in.
That fear made more so, I suspect, by comments from Israel's defence minister, Israel Katz, when he said all the houses in the villages adjacent to the border in Lebanon will be demolished. There are many people who simply have no idea where home is anymore.
Exactly. I met families yesterday in a shelter in Beirut. Of the million people, about 15% of them, 150,000 of them, are in government-run shelters. I met a baker from a village right on the border. He was bombed out of his bakery in November 2024, the last round of fighting. He set up a new bakery in Tyre, also in the south of Lebanon, on the coast, away from the border. He's been forced to leave there. And he and his wife actually, said to me, we just don't know whether we'll ever go home. We don't know, in your words, where home is. And I think it's the long-term nature of this. They know long-term here in Lebanon, and the fear is that we're going back into a long cycle with no good choices.
You're also warning this morning of a wider crisis facing the planet, what you've called a food security time bomb. What do you mean by that?
I think it's really important that people understand that there are three humanitarian effects of the crisis in the Middle East. The first is the direct impact on people who are killed and displaced. The second is the indirect economic impact because of the centrality of the Straits of Hormuz, not just to global energy supplies. 30% of fertilizer go through there. That's all stuck. And then the third element is obviously the wider geopolitics. What we're warning of today is that there's really 8 to 10 weeks until mid-June for a food security time bomb to be diffused. Remember, we're in a situation where already 45 million people are at severe levels of food insecurity. And the grave danger is that they get pushed over the precipice.
Now, Donald Trump's answer to this seems to be simple. The war will be over. It'll be over soon. The countries that need the Strait of Hormuz can then reopen it. In effect, he was saying overnight, what's the worry?
I think that the real reason that the Gulf countries were so queasy about starting this conflict is that they feared it would allow the Iranians to demonstrate the power that they've always believed that they had, notably because of their control over the Straits of Hormuz, notably because of the vulnerability of Gulf countries. And when I talk about the ripple effects, the geopolitics, that's really centered on a couple of things. First of all, the question of how the Iranian regime is going to use the power that it's deployed, assuming it remains in place. I think pretty much all the experts will tell you that the regime is showing remarkable signs of stability rather than instability. A second element of this is obviously the war has been of enormous benefit to Russia, and that has particular concerns for us in Europe. It has a direct impact on the war in Ukraine. The third element is, what are the lessons that the president learns from this war? How does he see those people who stood with him and those who he perceives to have undermined him? And obviously his comments about NATO are very, very worrying from a British or European point of view. And so I think that the wider geopolitics of this are going to be rolling out with as much impact as the economics, which we're seeing in energy markets and elsewhere.
So having spent, what, much of the last decade living in the United States, would your advice be to the politicians you know so well at home, hold your breath and wait for this Trump moment and era to end and get back to normal? Or is your conclusion, we're never getting back to normal?
My very clear view is that there's no going back. Anyone who tells you that, just hunker down, wait 2.5 years, hope there's a new American president and things will go back to the status quo ante, I just don't buy that. The old idea of the West, based on enlightened self-interest on the part of the United States that was willing to be, if you like, a benevolent hegemon around the world, that is not coming back. We should hold as firmly to those aspects of the American alliance that we can sustain. But obviously our geography is with Europe, and we're going to have to sustain and improve dramatically our engagement with the European Union and other European countries. And we're going to also have to think globally about the kind of alliances that are important for Britain. So if the beginning of your question was, can we just hold our breath and wait? The answer to that is no. We've got to take the sort of action that I think the Prime Minister was beginning to describe in his comments yesterday about our relationship with Europe. That's the starting point. It can't be the ending point.
Can I ask you one last personal question? There are lots of people listening to this who are deeply fearful when they look forward. Are you?
Well, I'm a very optimistic person, and I try and sustain that. But I think that the real challenges that exist at the global level, from security to climate to wider economic questions, mean that there's good reason for serious concern about what the future holds. Now, what I always then say after that is there are more resources to do more good than at any time in human history, and woe betide us if we miss that opportunity.
David Miliband, Chief Executive and President of the IRC, the International Rescue Committee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Nick.
It's 3 minutes to eight. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on Radio 4.
I told my dad, stop immediately, this is a scam.
Scam Secrets with me, Shari Val.
He had actually paid £209,000 to the scammers.
Each week, we expose a different scam in detail to help you spot the red flags.
I'll say things like, I carried on with it and I got great returns.
Yeah. With special insights from experts, including criminologists and a former scammer who now works to help prevent fraud.
When it's successful, it completely wipes people out.
The new series of Scam Secrets, this lunchtime at 12. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
Time for the weather now. Here's Ben Rich.
Nick, thank you very much. Good morning to you. A lot of fine weather around across most parts of the UK for today, but some rain will push in across northern and western areas later. So let's start the forecast across England and Wales. Most of us waking up to some sunny spells this morning, a bit of patchy cloud around as well. And through the day, that really is how things will remain. There is just a small chance of catching a light shower. The vast majority will be dry. And I think the best sunshine of all will be found across the far southwest of England. Now, for Northern Ireland and for Scotland, some sunny spells around this morning. It's quite a chilly start out there. But we will see cloud building from the west, and that cloud will bring some outbreaks of rain into Northern Ireland and Western Scotland during this afternoon. Some of that rain will be quite heavy and accompanied by some fairly brisk winds. But Eastern Scotland should hold on to some dry weather, and actually for the Northern Isles, I think we should see a fair bit of sunshine. Temperatures today ranging from 8 degrees in the northeast of Scotland to 12 in South Wales and Southern England. This evening and tonight, cloud and rain will spread southwards and eastwards, and some of that will linger for Good Friday morning. Quite breezy as well, something a bit brighter developing into northern areas during tomorrow afternoon, but still with some showers. And then as we head into Saturday, it should be a mainly fine start, but it will turn wet, and then it will actually turn very windy across northern areas of the UK on Saturday night.
Ben, thanks very much indeed. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Emma Barnett.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 2nd of April. The headlines this morning: NASA's Artemis 2 moon mission has blasted off, with its astronauts due to travel deeper into space than anyone has gone before.
3, 2, 1, booster ignition and liftoff. The crew of Artemis 2 now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
We'll be bringing you the highlights of a night of real drama and excitement in space and on the ground for all who've been watching. President Trump has used a televised address to say his war on Iran is nearing completion, and another 2 to 3 weeks of US strikes will, he says, bring them back to the Stone Ages. Oil prices have surged again. We'll hear from a former chief of staff to President Trump, a former national security adviser here in the UK. And our last headline this morning: the government has withdrawn an offer to create more training posts for doctors in England because they've refused to call off a 6-day strike.
Coming up in the next hour, we'll also be exploring if Prevent is fit for purpose. The chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee on what could replace the anti-radicalisation programme. And
I wanted to not feel depressed and anxious. And here was an influencer telling me how to not feel depressed and anxious.
And did you get really into that particular influencer?
They became a father figure to me. So I had like a painting of them on my wall.
Wow. What does happen when you get dragged into the so-called manosphere and toxic masculinity, as it also gets described as? Got a rare insight from someone, a man who was put into that world, or put himself there certainly, and then managed to escape it. But first, the news is read by Jane Steele.
NASA's first mission carrying astronauts to the moon in more than 50 years has blasted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. Artemis 2 is due to take the crew further into space than anyone has gone before. The astronauts won't land on the moon, but will pass its far side on a mission which NASA hopes will pave the way for a lunar landing in 2 years' time. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, was watching the launch in Florida.
3, 2, 1, booster ignition and liftoff.
Wow! Oh
my goodness, that is spectacular. It's not just what you see and you hear as the rocket lifts off. You can actually feel the force of it through your body. This is the most powerful rocket that NASA has ever built. Whoa. And it needs to be, because it's taking astronauts a quarter of a million miles away to the moon.
As the four astronauts headed skywards, leaving a plume of white smoke behind, the Artemis II commander, Reid Wiseman, spoke to Mission Control.
Houston Integrity, good last jettison, great view.
These are the first humans to head to the moon since 1972. Their first day will be spent in high orbit around the Earth, where they're checking out their spacecraft. A few issues with a brief loss of communications and the toilets have been identified, but nothing too serious so far. But if all looks okay, the go-ahead will be given for a blast of their main engine so they can begin their journey to the moon. During their 10-day mission, they'll be passing around its far side, the side we never see from Earth, before heading home and splashing down in the Pacific Ocean. This is a significant moment for NASA. Artemis II will pave the way for a lunar landing scheduled for 2028 and, eventually, a moon base.
President Trump has said the United States is getting very close to completing its military objectives in Iran. In a televised address from the White House, Mr. Trump said there would be a further 2 to 3 weeks of extremely hard strikes against Iran. Since his speech, oil prices have risen by 8% to $108 a barrel. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman was listening.
This appeared to be President Trump's mission nearly accomplished moment, but with the extraordinary caveat that Iran's grip over oil transit through the Strait of Hormuz was essentially not America's problem. While he said the US would help, he reiterated his demand that countries who rely on the Strait for their energy supplies should take the lead in reopening it.
Build up some delayed courage, should have done it before, should have done it with us, as we asked. Go to the Strait and just take it, protect it, use it for yourselves. Iran has been essentially decimated. The hard part is done, so it should be easy. And in any event, when this conflict is over, the Strait will open up naturally.
Mr. Trump suggested the U.S. could wrap up its military operations soon, but in the meantime, he threatened overwhelming destruction.
We are on track to complete all of America's military objectives shortly, very shortly. We're going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages, where they belong.
Despite saying Iran had been crushed militarily, Mr. Trump still demanded that it do a deal with the United States without setting out anything about the terms. He once again vowed that if it didn't, the US would bomb all of Iran's power plants.
In response to Mr. Trump's speech, Iran's military vowed to carry out crushing attacks against the United States and Israel. With his assessment of the president's address, here's our chief North America correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue.
This speech was largely a rehash of what President Trump has been saying for days. Copy and paste his social media posts over the last week or so, and you'd get last night's address to the nation. There were also a number of glaring omissions, which leave a plethora of questions unanswered. First, Israel. Does Benjamin Netanyahu's government agree with this timetable? We just don't know. Second, what happened to the idea of retrieving the hundreds of kilos of enriched uranium buried under rubble from last year's 12-day war? Third, what is the president's settled view on the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz? Now he says it would reopen naturally when the war is over. And finally, is he serious about pulling out of NATO? The truth is that after 20 minutes of a national address, we're really none the wiser about what victory in this war looks like. And given the often conflicting nature of the president's views from one day to the next, everything could change at any time.
The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, is due to host a virtual meeting of 35 foreign ministers today to discuss diplomatic measures that could be taken to restore freedom of navigation through the Strait of Hormuz. The United States won't be involved. The chief executive of the International Rescue Committee, David Miliband, told us that as well as restricting fuel shipments, Iran's blockade of the strait had had a devastating impact on supplies of food.
There's really 8 to 10 weeks until mid-June for a food security time bomb to be defused. Remember, we're in a situation where already 45 million people are at severe levels of food insecurity. And the grave danger is that they get pushed over the precipice.
The government has withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors in England. The Prime Minister had given the doctors' union, the British Medical Association, 48 hours to call off a six-day strike due to start next Tuesday or face losing the training posts. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
A pay and jobs deal offered by the government to the BMA included a commitment to create 1,000 more training posts this year for newly qualified doctors to progress in their careers. With a lot more applicants than places last year, the BMA said some doctors were facing unemployment. The Department of Health said because the BMA had not agreed to call off the strike and put the offer to members, it wasn't possible for the system to deliver the new training posts and manage the NHS safely during strike action. The BMA said it had consistently maintained that industrial action could be postponed if there was a genuinely credible offer. Neither side has formally walked away from talks, though the possibility of any further negotiations before the strike looks remote.
It's understood the BBC decided to sack the Radio 2 presenter Scott Mills after learning that allegations of historical sexual offences had involved a boy under 16. The police investigation was closed in 2019 because prosecutors decided there was insufficient evidence to bring charges. The BBC said yesterday it had been made aware of the investigation in 2017, but new information had come to light in recent weeks. Scott Mills said he had fully cooperated with the police. Black boxes, which monitor a person's driving, will be fitted to all new Motability vehicles when the driver is under the age of 30. The scheme allows disabled people to use their mobility allowance to lease a new car. Those running it say the change will keep insurance costs down after some tax breaks were removed in the last budget. Here's our disability reporter, Emma Tracy.
Black boxes are often offered to 16 to 24-year-olds in return for lower insurance premiums. But later this month, they'll be compulsory for all new Motability customers under the age of 30. Drive Smart, the technology used by the scheme, rates things including speed and smoothness of driving. But one user told the Access All podcast she consistently got lower scores because braking and accelerating with hand controls registered as jerky driving. The Motability Foundation said the boxes were about keeping prices down and people safe. It said they would help it avoid passing on the cost of increased tax to disabled people.
New rules to make it easier to cancel subscriptions have been announced by the government. More details from our business reporter, Peter Ruddick.
From magazines to streaming services, there are 155 million active subscriptions across the UK. However, the government has said 10 million of them are unwanted because people haven't cancelled a trial in time or because the process to exit is complicated. From next spring, companies will have to provide clear information from the start, a 14-day cooling-off period and renewal reminders. Firms will also have to make it as straightforward to cancel as it is to sign up. Ministers say consumers should save an average of £14 a month per subscription. The rules were first proposed in November 2024. Since then, some charities and cultural organisations have been allowed an exemption.
People waiting at bus stops across England will now be able to track their service using Google Maps. The technology is already in use in London. Ministers hope the scheme will save people time and ensure fewer passengers are left standing at isolated or poorly lit stops.
Jane, thank you very much. It's 11 minutes past eight. It happened. NASA's launch of Artemis II, the historic moon mission, was a success. How pleased I am to be able to say that to you, and I'm sure you are to hear. And there are now four astronauts on their way to the moon for the first time in more than half a century.
GLS, go for ELS.
Great call out. The rocket is on its own. Four brave explorers ready to ride the most powerful rocket NASA has ever launched. Sound suppression, water is flowing.
15.
And here we go. 10, 9, 8, 7. RS-25 engines lit. 4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition. And lift off. The crew of Artemis II now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
It's a great way to start your day, and what a journey to be able to almost commentate on there that you hear. From then, it was a rapid ascent into space for those four astronauts.
Communication signal transfer confirmed as Integrity and its crew go supersonic. Approaching 90 seconds into the Artemis II mission, Integrity is 14 miles in altitude, 8 miles downrange, traveling more than 2,600 miles per hour.
And then, less than 4 minutes into the mission, they were in space.
3 minutes, 50 seconds into the flight of Artemis II, Wiseman, Glover, Cook, and Hansen cross the boundary to space with good comm checks.
And we have a beautiful moonrise. We're headed right at it.
There you go. Let's get into it. How important will this mission be? You may be watching the live feed. I've certainly got it up, and we've been seeing what's been going on from pre-sleep to getting ready to go into sleeping bags to the very set schedule and what's already been seen, several moonrises. But how important will this mission be? Why are they going? These four explorers, I mean, we've been hearing what they've gone through to get to this position, but now they're in it. And what needs to happen for it to be deemed a success? Let me talk first now to Rebecca Morell, our science editor, who was at the launch, still in Florida. Rebecca, hello. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, it really was a spectacle. I mean, the rocket that took the astronauts up at the start of their journey, you know, it's nearly 100 metres tall. It's the most powerful rocket that NASA's ever built. And just think, you've got these four human beings strapped into their capsule right at the top of the rocket, and it's filled with millions of litres of explosive fuel. And just seeing it go up, first of all, you get the flash of the bright light. We were about 3 miles away from it. You have to keep a safe distance. And then the roar, the sound, the crackles kind of comes across. And actually, you get a physical sensation moving through your body. You really feel the force of the liftoff as you see them blast off. And, it starts very slowly, kind of lumbering up upwards off of the launch pad, and then it really quickly accelerates off into space, and you're just left behind with this white plume. I mean, it was pretty spectacular to see it down from the ground. I mean, it must have been quite a ride for the astronauts on board too. They'd have been experiencing some pretty strong G-forces.
Indeed. And what's lovely, Rebecca, is how professional and calm you sound right now. Have a listen to this.
Oh my goodness, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Oh,
that is the sound of you when it was actually happening, which we've got recorded.
Yeah, I really kept my cool, didn't I?
I really
kept my cool. I think
what's lovely
definitely
is to
not hear, excited.
Well, no, but it's lovely to actually hear the excitement around this. There aren't many news stories, certainly at the moment, where people can have a feeling that something is bigger than them, that there is shared endeavour, and that there is, you know, regardless of how you feel about space, whether you've never engaged with it or not, that there is more that can be done and more that can be pushed. And I suppose it's tapping into that, Rebecca.
I think that's it. I mean, we're standing here, it's pitch black here at the Kennedy Space Centre. Everyone's gone home. But above us, you've got, a very, very bright full moon. And just this idea that, four astronauts are on their way to it. In a few days' time, they'll be travelling around the far side of the moon, the side we never see from Earth. They'll be taking amazing images of the far side of the moon. They'll be giving audio descriptions too. This is the thing I really like. The scientists have asked them to give audio descriptions of the geology of the moon. You know, if they spot an interesting crater, they have to describe what it looks like. And I think for me, humans haven't been to the moon in more than 50 years. The moon is a quarter of a million miles away. To put that into perspective, the International Space Station, where astronauts have been spending the last 25 years, is about 250 miles above the Earth. It's a really big distance that they're going to be covering.
And I think it is indeed.
To see the start of that journey, it was spectacular.
Spectacular indeed. Rebecca Morell, thank you for being with us. Thank you for staying at the Kennedy Station still to talk to us when everyone else has gone home. Our science editor there. Well, joining us on the line, Professor Krista Fuglsang, the first Swedish astronaut who flew on missions in 2006 and 2009, now a professor in spaceflight at the KTH Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm. And back with us in the studio, Professor Kevin Fong, Professor of Public Engagement and Innovation at UCL. Also, you may have heard his podcast past 16 sunsets around the history and about the history of the NASA Space Shuttle program. Welcome back, Kevin. Hello to you, Krista. Thank you for being with us. I mean, Krista, if I could just come to you. So we've been speaking to Kevin throughout the program. I want to come back to him as well, of course. What does this mean to you? What was it like for you seeing this successful launch?
Well, it was great. It was really, finally. I remember when I got selected as an astronaut in 1992, and then I looked at the moon and I was thinking, wow, I might go there soon. But things are taking a little bit more time.
Yes.
Now, they are not going to land on the moon, but they will at least go around the moon. And I think we have a very strong, solid moon program.
Chris,
kind of moving on now.
I was going to say, Christopher, for you, how important could this mission be? You know, what needs to happen for this to be a success?
Well, for a success, I would say they must be able to go around the moon and come back safely. Of course, there might probably be a lot of some technical issues, and that's why this is done. I mean, it's a kind of rehearsal mission before landing on the moon. Next time you go towards the moon.
Yes. Well, Kevin, bring you back in, if you're not too jealous to be on air with someone who did qualify as an astronaut because you wanted to, but you did get quite close, let's say. Your excitement, and you've been with us all throughout the morning, you know, and we heard it with Rebecca, you know, tapping into that, is it already a success in some ways, do you think?
It's already a success in many ways, isn't it? I mean, we're here talking about it now, that is a success on its own, but what lies ahead is a chapter of great excitement. I mean, I keep saying this to people, this is the most exciting period in human space exploration for over half a century. And the world will get it when we start to see this stuff happen. I cannot wait for what is to come.
And just to put this, you know, I was saying about the live feed that some may be monitoring, you know, around 37,000 miles away from Earth, they are right now, 218,000 miles to go to the moon. The distances, how do you get your head around that, Kevin?
It's pretty hard to get your head around it. And everything is superlative. I mean, you heard them talking about the launch there. You're talking about more than 2,000 tons of vehicle that goes from 0 to 17,500 miles an hour over 8 minutes. So all of it is just impossible to imagine, but that's the energy that it takes. That's why this thing is so impressive, right? That you've got this engineering and this science, this technology that can take that explosive capacity and control it and send it so precisely to somewhere that you know, we can see on a night sky.
And the shared endeavour aspect of it, you know, that the teamwork that goes on behind. When we talk about, it's quite unsexy when we talk about STEM, science and technology. I want it to be as appealing as possible, but you know, the acronym and the way that we can sometimes talk about science, technology, engineering, all that, those spheres. And we've often talked about getting different groups into it, especially women and different backgrounds, thinking it for them. You know, you've spoken how your life got pointed towards science by your interest in space. But when you see something like this, it does allow you, I suppose, to understand how big something could be, how big your life could be.
Yeah, and you know, the first time they went to the moon in Apollo 8, the first images we get of the Earth hanging against the void, the borderless globe, you know, in all its beauty. So it tells you something about what we're capable of together. This crew, it's a diverse crew. You've got Victor Glover, first Black American in space. You've got Christina Cook, first woman to go around the moon. And Jeremy Hansen, first Canadian, first non-American citizen to go around the moon. So a lovely diverse crew, but there's more than that. This is a system of hundreds of thousands of people, and it will take teams across the world. So, you know, I hope this will bring us together. When they went in 68, it was a period of unrest. The United States was at war in Vietnam. There'd been political assassinations. And at the end of 1968, the crew coasting around the moon sort of brought the world together. I hope this will do the same.
There's a huge amount of unrest again. And it isn't, you know, I don't want to be misunderstood when I say about, you know, making something sound appealing. It's when you talk about certain things as subjects versus seeing science in action, seeing technology in action. That's what I was trying to bring alive with that. Professor Krista Fuglsang, to come back to you as a Swedish astronaut, you know, what can you give us a sense of what the astronauts may be going through?
Yeah, it's a very quick and shaky ride up on 8 minutes, a little bit more than 8 minutes, and then suddenly you're up there, and you're in weightlessness. That's the first amazing thing. I mean, you're just floating around, and you will be floating around until you're back on Earth. That is both fun and a new way of living, but sometimes a bit complicated. I mean, you cannot put things away and you can easily get some medical issues to start with. Another thing is the view of doors. Seeing the beautiful doors down there, they are still not very far away compared to the moon. Yes. They would go 1,000 times further away. But you go around the Earth, takes only 90 minutes, and you see new things all the time. And you see this is a small kind of spaceship by itself in the huge universe which we all live on, which we have to take care of.
Professor Christa Fuglsang, thank you for that. Just finally, to come back to you, Professor Kevin Fong, you know, what they will see and how, having interviewed a few astronauts now over my career, and I feel, you know, in some of the conversations where you really get to ask many, many questions, and you will have done the same, is that they have a new perspective on life. That, you know, how could you not from what you see? So already we heard a little bit of audio earlier from seeing a few moonrises. They reported back already. But what will they see?
So they're going to see parts of the moon that nobody has seen for more than half a century. Some of it, parts of the moon that no one has ever seen, because they're seeing it illuminated for the first time. But that point you make about it changing their perspective, my favourite story of this is I had lunch once with Alan Bean, who's the Apollo 12 lunar module pilot. And he said after he'd been to the moon, the first thing he did when they got back and out of quarantine was he went to a shopping centre and he sat down and bought an ice cream and just watched people coming and going, because suddenly that was the most amazing thing he'd ever seen. And that's what it's about, right? Understanding our place in all of this. Yeah. And how we are one globe, one fragile life support system hovering in the void. That's what it's about.
The perspective of that. I mean, that's pretty epic versus the perspective he would have also had out of the window or two. Professor Kevin Fong, thank you.
Orbital. If you've not read that, Booker Prize winner, that captures what it's like for the astronauts and cosmonauts of the past, and no doubt those today as well. It's now 24 minutes past 8. Let's turn to the other big news story overnight, which is President Trump's address to the nation. When it was announced, some believed that it would set out a plan to bring America's war with Iran to a close, or explain the need to escalate it to force the regime in Tehran to buckle. There was none of that. Instead, it looked like he was trying to convince voters who don't much like paying $4 a gallon for gas that the war was going well and would end soon.
I've made clear from the beginning of Operation Epic Fury that we will continue until our objectives are fully achieved. Thanks to the progress we've made, I can say tonight that we are on track to complete all of America's military objectives shortly, very shortly. We're going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong.
That chilling promise, rather a contrast to the talk a day or two ago of offering Iran's new regime, or at least as he portrays them, a 15-point plan for talks. Amongst those listening and analysing what was and what was not said was former White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, who served Donald Trump in his first term.
Donald Trump operates with a cultivated unpredictability, what I call strategic ambiguity. He doesn't feel at all bound by those 15-point terms previously. He's set the goals now, and that those are the goals as of this evening. And that will essentially, I suppose, be the measure of success moving forward. Can he guarantee that Iran will not have a nuclear weapon going forward? That was sort of the marker he laid down this evening.
And Mulvaney says that whatever the wider worries, Donald Trump's backers in the United States are still sticking by their man.
He has still tremendous political support from his base, from the MAGA Republican, the MAGA wing of the Republican Party. I've seen numbers as high as 90% of the hardcore right wingers. And keep in mind, the people that are around him are going to be telling him that. He surrounds himself, as many leaders do, with folks that are on his side. So there are political risks. There's no question. But keep in mind, he's not running for office again. So those polling numbers are more relevant to members of the House and the Senate who have to stand for re-election in November. So the political status here is still very solid with the president, changeable in the next several months. But I don't think he went on tonight in a sense of political panic.
It was, of course, watched right round the world and not just in the United States. We're joined by Mark Sedwill, Lord Sedwill, former Cabinet Secretary, former National Security Advisor during the first Trump administration, who is currently travelling in the Middle East, having had meetings with a number of senior figures in the Gulf. Good morning to you, Lord Sedwill.
Good morning, Nick. How are you?
I was very struck by a phrase Mick Mulvaney used there, the goals as of this evening. It's the first time I've heard a war's goals change, not just by the day, but by the hour. Are you any clearer having watched that speech?
Not much, truthfully, but I think he is signalling he wants an off-ramp, and I think he's trying now to define success as having essentially decimated Iran's conventional weapons capability, ballistic missiles, their navy, their conventional forces and so on, and thus meaning that they can't convert their continuing holdings of uranium stockpiles, enriched uranium stockpiles, into nuclear weapons and thus a threat. That's a more limited goal than he was at least hinting at earlier in the campaign. He might change again, but it looks to me like he's now looking for an off-ramp and to be able to declare mission accomplished in that way.
At a time when drones and missiles are still hitting targets in the Gulf, at a time when ships, most of them, cannot make their way through the Straits of Hormuz unless they're regimes that Iran favours, how will that be regarded in the Gulf?
With real concern. I mean, what I'm struck by here is actually how resilient the Gulf countries have proved to be. They have good air defences, they've planned for this, and they've also actually prepared their populations for it. So just last night, there were alerts coming out on my phone saying that missiles were incoming and giving us some advice, and then an all-clear this morning. And it is also striking that although this war from the Iranian point of view is about the United States and Israel, they actually have launched more attacks against their Gulf neighbours than they have even against against Israel. And that's because their plan is for a war of resistance, not a conventional war against the Americans. And they're seeking to attack the United States and the West through the energy markets and the economy. And that's why they're attacking oil infrastructure and America's Gulf allies. And of course, why, as you say, they've got a chokehold on the Straits of Hormuz, and that's what's led to these high oil prices.
Well, let's
that's
turn to that.
They if can we continue, could. And that's what the Gulf countries fear if the mission is left only half finished.
Yeah, let's turn to that then. Donald Trump was highly critical yesterday before the speech of Britain and Europe for being slow to act on the Strait of Hormuz. Some of that criticism repeated in his speech again in the Gulf. Do they agree with that criticism?
No, but they do want the UK and other nations to work with them to get the Straits of Hormuz open. They are, I think, resigned to the likelihood that the United States will only play a partial role in that. Although some of what President Trump has said in the past, including in this speech, his threats against Iran's oil infrastructure, the speculation of a land operation against their oil shipment terminal in the Kharg Island, suggests he might be essentially saying to them, open the straits or I'll hit your oil infrastructure too. That might be part of what he's signalling to them, but that isn't completely clear. Now, the Gulf countries do want the rest of us alongside them to open the straits, notwithstanding the fact that, like the UK, like others, they recognise this problem hasn't arisen because of them or because of us, but they do want our help.
Now, another running theme in recent days has been the mounting criticism of NATO from Donald Trump and the frustration that, as he sees it, Europe wasn't there for him and wasn't there for America when help was needed. You served the Prime Minister during the time when Donald Trump was making threats to leave NATO back in 2017 and onwards. What's your attitude to the threats you're hearing now? Take them seriously or just dismiss them as, yeah, he says these things, but he's not going to do it?
No, I think we have to take them seriously, although not quite literally. So the president himself can't actually withdraw the United States from NATO. That would require a two-thirds majority in the Senate, and there's no chance of that happening. But what he can do is seriously undermine the United States' military guarantee, the Article 5 guarantee, the deployment of troops, etc., essentially on his own initiative. And so the lesson for Europe, by the way, it's exactly the same as the lesson here in the Gulf, is that we still need the United States, all of us, but we also have to all do more ourselves. That's the best way to keep the Americans bound in and build up more sovereign capability. The truth is, the Gulf are on that agenda. they'll move more quickly probably than we're seeing in Europe. They tend to go for action rather than speeches.
They've also got quite a lot more money, I suspect. But Lord Sedwell, Mark Sedwell, thank you very much indeed for joining us, the former National Security Advisor and former Cabinet Secretary.
It's 28 minutes to nine. Meeta Glenny has just joined us in the studio. Lovely to see you face to face. So tell us a bit more about what's coming up in this morning's In Our Time.
Good morning, Emma. We'll be discussing the Spanish-American War of 1898, a short conflict with a lasting impact on Spain and the US, on Cuba and the Philippines, where it was largely fought, and on world affairs. The US had objected to the harsh way Spain was resisting the Cuban independence movement, and the US Navy triumphed from Manila to Santiago de Cuba, marking the arrival of the US as an imperial power on the world stage and guaranteeing a Cuban independence of sorts. Historians argue it's a pivotal moment in global history. That's the Spanish-American War of 1898 with Mary Vincent, Frank Cogliano and Stephen Wilkinson on In Our Time on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds just after 9 a.m. And now back to Nick with some pivotal moments of our own.
Misha, thank you very much indeed. Well, not a pivotal moment so much as the weather. And the news is, it's going to be sunny for many. Cloud gradually increasing from the west. I'm afraid if you're listening to this in Northern Ireland or West Scotland, you're going to get heavy rain and wind later.
Well, it could be pivotal. Let's see. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Emma Barnett. It's 27 minutes to nine. And now a summary of the news with James Steele.
NASA has said it's back in the business of sending astronauts to the moon after the successful launch of the Artemis II mission from Cape Canaveral in Florida. The crew won't land on the moon, but will pass its far side. The space agency's administrator confirmed the four astronauts were all safe and in great spirits. President Trump has said the US is very close to achieving its military objectives in Iran. He said another 2 to 3 weeks of extremely hard strikes would send the Iranians back to the Stone Ages. Oil prices are up by 7% since he spoke, at just under $108 a barrel. The Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper will host a virtual meeting of 35 foreign ministers today. They'll discuss how to restore freedom of navigation to the Strait of Hormuz. The government has withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors in England. The Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, had been given 48 hours to call off a six-day strike due to start next week or lose the training posts. The BMA says it is extremely disappointed.
Jane, thanks very much. And now let's get the latest on the sport. Mike's here. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Emma. Well, I know Nick has just given the weather, but I can make a proclamation that summer is officially here. For many people, at least, because the official start of summer is tomorrow. The first day, of course, of cricket's new county championship season. Nottinghamshire are defending champions alongside the familiar names of Surrey, Yorkshire, Essex and others. There is a new team back in the top division of English cricket for the first time since 2003. Leicestershire were promoted as Division 2 champions last season. And earlier this week, I went down to Grace Road to meet the team as they prepare for life back in the big time.
For over two decades, Leicestershire were, more often than not, the butt of the joke in the county championship.
That should be enough. Two would win it. Oh! It's misfielded. They're going to come back for two. Oh, an unbelievable misfield from Leicestershire.
Since 2009, no team finished bottom of Division 2 more often. A miserable period for the club that even included a 37-match winless run.
Leicestershire have somehow, through two misfields, given this away in the most unbelievable way.
But all that changed last season.
After 22 years, Leicestershire are promoted. The Foxes will play with the elite next season after all this time.
The team surprised everyone by romping the Division 2 title by almost 50 points.
Last year was amazing. We played some really good cricket, and to be lining up in Division 1 this year is really exciting, and we can't wait to take on all the teams that are in the division. Hi, I'm Lewis Hill and I'm a batter at Leicestershire County Cricket Club.
What does it mean to the fans, to the city of Leicester itself, to have a top-flight cricket side for the first time in two decades?
There's been a few tougher times in the last kind of 10 years where we've been at the bottom. So to have success, you've seen it on people's faces. We've been building to this for 3 or 4 years. We've gradually got better each year. So to see everybody smile and say Division 1 cricket is at Grace Road, it's a privilege to play every day.
Well, it is a grey and overcast morning here at Grace Road, but the entire Leicestershire first team are busy in front of me on the outfield in one of their final training sessions before their first match back in the First Division for 23 years.
There's a lot of excitement around. Players, supporters, looking forward to it. Going to see how we match up against the best in the country. Hi, I'm Alfonso Thomas, and I'm the head coach of Leicestershire County Cricket Club. I don't think we've got a lot to lose, but we've got a hell of a lot to gain. So I want the guys to go play with no fear, but at the same time, I want the guys to most definitely show the character and the fight that they have been showing for the last couple of years.
That is absolutely incredible. Leicestershire win by 2 runs. They can barely believe it themselves.
Hello.
Hi there, Mr. Folds.
It is.
Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, very good. It's a pleasure.
We've left Grace Road for a moment to visit the house of one of the oldest former Leicestershire players. Fred Folds is 91 in a few weeks, and he's delighted to see his old club's upturn in fortunes.
My first game for Leicestershire First 11 was at Cambridge in 52.
And as a Leicestershire lad, born and bred, what did it mean to you to play for Leicestershire?
Well, it's got to be the top, isn't it? In the 50s, we didn't have to go through all this training as they do now. I mean, you've got a trainer for wicket-keeping, bowling, batting, fielding. They check on what you eat. The whole sport is different. I was at the Oval watching the match when they won it.
In 1975?
In 75.
And then Leicestershire won 2 more county championships in the 1990s.
They did.
But since then, in the last 20 years or so...
Yes, it's gone down a bit.
What does it mean now for Leicestershire to finally
be back in the top flight?
To
be back with the big boys. I am proud, yes. Let's hope that they can do well and stay there. It's going to test a few players, but that's OK. Great to see them back in the top division, you know, while I'm here.
We're just standing on the boundary rope here at Grace Road, and you can tell a new season is just around the corner because the perimeter advertising hoardings are being hammered into place on the outfield.
We try our hardest every single day, and it's good to see the success last year. To see the bad times and now the good times of being Division 1 this year and ready to take on the challenges, again, it's a privilege to play.
You must have heard of the glory days, the days of Gower and Agnew, the halcyon days for Leicestershire, particularly in the 1980s and 90s. You, as a modern-day Leicestershire player, probably think, well, we want to make our own history, right?
Yeah, definitely. I said a couple of years ago that we always wanted a picture on the wall of the team now. So there's lots of, as you said, the Gower team and all the T20 teams that have won the trophy over the years. So we've got that now twice, so we need to make another success story, hopefully.
Batter Lewis Hill there, ending my time up in Leicestershire earlier this week. Thanks to the club for having me down. A lot of excitement, as you can tell, around Grace Road as they make their long-awaited return to the top flight, which you can follow, I should say, on BBC Sounds ball-by-ball commentary of every game in the county championship all throughout the season between now and September over on BBC Sounds.
Mike, thanks very much. It's 20 to 9. This week on my podcast, Ready to Talk, a rare insight into the manosphere from someone who has spent way too much time there and was drawn deeper and deeper into this complicated space that we know a bit more about, but still not enough. This was happening as his job and personal relationships faltered. It's rare, as my guest Will Adolfi speaks about candidly, to hear what were deeply unpalatable views he came to hold, and how he came out of the other side. Will now works as a psychotherapist and runs workshops helping men and boys understand how toxic the online world of male influencers can be. But as he explains, a decade ago, he still found himself drawn to it.
I was still feeling pressure to be a real man and to be successful. And I was failing. I wasn't earning a lot of money. And then on the other hand, there was this pressure that I was experiencing to not be toxic. And so it felt like it was coming from both sides.
What did that mean, that frustration? Were you going online and hurling abuse?
No. So it was mostly internal. I was watching a lot of videos in my room and I was feeling a lot of resentment towards the world. And the resentment was, I'm more than just a straight white man.
Yeah, so anyone talking about white men at that time?
Yeah, I got told that I was privileged. It was that sort of stuff. You know, you got it easy. And at this point in my life, I really didn't want to be here. Like, I was in survival mode. I was having the panic attacks. My mental health had deteriorated. So, yeah, it was
that in itself is obviously not small. These are very real symptoms and serious symptoms. You're not just angry all the time. You're actually suffering.
Mostly in anxiety and hopelessness. That was most of what I was feeling. And then when this narrative came along about that I was seeing a lot online about how I was privileged, I'm a straight white man, and it just activated me. It really did. I felt this sense of like, you guys don't get it. You just don't get it. You don't get what I'm experiencing. I just don't want to be here. So how can I be privileged? So that was what was going on.
And so what sort of messages about women were you receiving that landed more than they would have done normally, do you think?
The very clear messaging was feminism is a poison. Like, that was the very clear messaging. So it was more feminism. It's like, feminism is what's bad for the world, and it's bad for men. And the world is kind of rigged against men. So these messages and this kind of grievance within me, this kind of sense of like, yeah, actually people don't get it. But then when I was listening to someone online who was essentially saying this, I was like, God, this guy gets it. You know, he gets me. He gets me. He's empathizing with me as a man. And that was what really pulled me in a lot of the time. And so, I just want to make this clear. I was primarily watching for self-help because I felt so depressed and anxious. I wanted to not feel depressed and anxious. And here was an influencer telling me how to not feel depressed and anxious.
And did you get really into that particular influencer?
They became a father figure to me. So I had like a painting of them on my wall.
Wow.
In every conversation that I was in with people, I would often quote them. And the guidance I got online in my 20s, it got me out of the ditch I was in. And that's something that's really confusing as well for people. Like, I used to say, this guy saved my life.
Yeah, because they teach you how to get fit. Or the importance of getting fit rather than being a trainer, right? And they give you some rigor and some, like, a framework,
a map, a masculinity map. You know, this is what you're going to do to get yourself out of the predicament that you're in. It was a performance-based version of masculinity. Mm. So I was bolstering my self-esteem, but I was neglecting my self-worth. I think a lot of what I see online is like creating this illusion of happiness through material means. So pictures of the cars and also money. Like, these people have, a lot of people online that I was following have a lot of money. And that does feel like that's what I need to feel dignity, to feel self-worth. I need money. But what I try and help boys and men understand, which is something that I feel like I've learned, which has really helped me, is that the chase is never ending. I thought that once I achieved success, that my nervous system would be able to settle into it and I'd feel enough. But actually what happened was the goalposts just change. They just keep moving. And it's never ending. It's a never ending chase.
Fascinating. A lot more he shares, and also what it's like to come out of that world. Will Adolfi there, this week's guest on Ready to Talk. Look it up, Ready to Talk with Emma Barnett. It's available tomorrow morning on BBC Sounds.
Now, we're still listening to the live communications between the Artemis crew inside the Orion spacecraft and Mission Control in Houston. We thought they'd gone to sleep because they'd been working through a pre-sleep checklist before they could call it a day. But there's been signs of them waking. We've been even dropping on their communications, discussing lots of things, inevitably some of them quite mundane.
Are we safe to assume that any toilet non-use that's not per Optimus you would call up? We're thinking about calling you to see if we can use it for the next like 20 minutes or so before we sleep, and instead wanted to check that assumption.
We'll be hearing more from the spacecraft and hearing from Dame Maggie Adarin and Matthew Cosby of the Earth Space Station in Cornwall a little bit later in the programme. Now, though, at 14 minutes to nine, let's turn to a new warning coming from MPs on the Home Affairs Select Committee, who say that PREVENT, the programme designed to stop people from becoming terrorists or supporting terrorism, is an outdated programme and inadequately prepared to deal with the new challenge of extremism spread and bred online. The chair of that parliamentary committee is Dame Karen Bradley, and she joins us now. Good morning to you, Dame Karen.
Good morning, Nick.
Outdated in what way?
So I think, to be clear, Prevent does really good work when it comes to dealing with people with ideology who are the definition of terrorism. So it's very good at de-radicalising people who are at risk of becoming radicalised for an ideology. What it isn't able to deal with is people who are prone to nihilistic violence but are not radicalised due to ideology. They are just people who are interested in committing violent acts, obsessed with violence, and need help and support to make sure that they don't actually go on and commit that violence. And that's where Prevent isn't really, it's just not equipped to do that.
And one of the reasons you and others on the committee have drawn this conclusion is the experience of that Southport attack.
Yeah. So we started doing this work when we did a piece of work right at the beginning of the of our session on the policing response to the disorder that occurred after the Southport attack. But we were disturbed when we heard about the referrals to Prevent that the perpetrator had and how Prevent hadn't been able to intervene, because he didn't have an ideology. He wasn't committing the violence he committed because he wants to change the constitution or create a caliphate or destroy people of a certain religion. He was doing this because he just wants to commit violence. He just wanted to hurt and kill people. And we think that this means the government needs to put an extra layer in so that there is a triage that's done for people that like him or that are people who might turn to terrorism, that this extra triage is put in, and that if they are somebody that's found to have the ideology and that radicalisation, yes, go to Prevent. That's absolutely right. But if they're not, there needs to be another programme which might have very similar look very similar to Prevent, but actually is dealing with this underlying desire to commit violence, not for an ideological reason, just because the individual is obsessed with violence.
And the need for this, to remind people, is because the suspect in that case was multiply referred to authorities, wasn't he, but didn't meet the criteria for Prevent.
Absolutely. And that's exactly the point, Nick, that there could have been interventions that could have been made that could have identified that this individual was online accessing content that was leading him to commit violence. And, you know, we just heard that last piece that you had from who was online and the influencers and what they did there. There are community groups where young, predominantly men, we didn't hear of any examples of women, young boys and men are online talking to each other. They all have an interest in violence. They are encouraged to commit violent acts on webcams to promote themselves to their followers. There are people making a lot of money from this, of course. There are people who are there raising money from these acts, and they are encouraged to go out and commit violence. And we think that there needs to be an intervention made earlier. And we also think the government needs to be talking to the tech companies to make sure that they understand how these algorithms work, because the AI that's there now and the algorithms are simply not well understood. We need more evidence and more data on that.
Dame Karen Bradley, Chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee, thank you.
It's 11 minutes to nine. That is nearly all from us. Don't worry, I've not got the memo and realising we're only ending 10 minutes early. We're not. Our editors today, let me tell you, though, were Tom Smithard and Laura Hendry, and Studio Director Gabriel O'Regan. But we want to spend the last few minutes of the programme reflecting on this historic moon mission. I mean, the night before that was, it really is something. And throughout the programme, I'm sure you've been feeling it as well, but huge excitement that this happened, that the launch was successful, that NASA has this success, and it's something you can follow live. We've been also bringing you what's been going on, some of it mundane, some of it extraordinary, all of it in between. These four astronauts on this mission, this incredible mission, and it's only just ending that day for the four astronauts on the Orion spacecraft. They signed off with Mission Control in the last few moments.
Thanks for an awesome first day. We are climbing into our sleeping bags.
We copy all, Christina, and with that, it has been a fantastic day with you all, and good rest, and we look forward to working with you tomorrow.
We do as well. Take care, guys.
What a day. Signing off for some sleep. We've heard about the pre-sleep. We've heard about the sleeping bags. We're now hearing about the sleep. And let's see how well they do with that, because as we're also hearing from Professor Kevin Fong, who's been with us throughout the programme, who's worked with NASA as a medic, but also a keen interest in this, that, you know, sleep is a key part of still being able to perform well. This is a high performance, high intensity environment. Joining us now, Dame Maggie Adarin, a space scientist, presenter, of course, of the World Service podcast, 13 Minutes Presents Artemis 2, and Matthew Cosby, Chief Technology Officer at the Goonhilly Earth Station in Cornwall. Welcome to you both. Dame Maggie Adarin, first to you, I must ask, how are you feeling about this as it becomes, I suppose, our reality, all of our realities, that it's been a successful launch so far?
Yeah, it is still quite mind-boggling, because I was there in February sort of rooting for it to go up, and there was a window in March, but that sort of went by, and sort of the 1st of April, April Fool's Day, you thought, is it going to work? But I was watching with my daughter, and there was a few moments of a sort of trepidation where I think that some signals went down and things like that. But it was a textbook launch, and it was an epic moment. And my daughter and I were there cheering. So it is a great relief.
Matthew, let me bring you in on this. Have you got your head around it yet?
Yeah, well, I also, as Dame Maggie was watching with her family, I was watching as well with my family. I got the children to watch as well. So, yeah, it is... It's mind-boggling. It's great. But the launch, which was delayed into the launch window, we had the antenna all configured for the launch window, so we just had to reconfigure it with the new trajectory. So it was a bit of nervousness there, because we had to do a bit more work to get ready. So for us, it's as soon as it goes, we've got to start working. We've got to start getting the systems ready and the procedures up and running to start tracking.
I think everybody on the programme so far has been excited. So I'm going to put the sceptical question, Dame Maggie. There may be one or two people who go, quite a lot of money. What's it all for?
Yes, and especially, we've been to the moon before, you know, over 50 years ago. Why are we going again now? And so it's a question I've been asked a lot. And I think the answer is why we're going to the moon. So it was 50 years ago, and in the Apollo programs, it was about sort of saber rattling. It was the space race. But now I feel we're going to the moon with purpose. So one of the things that's happened in the hiatus since the last moon landings is we've sent lots of probes around the moon. They've been orbiting. And one of the discoveries is the potential of frozen water at the South Pole. So there's an indication that it's there. We don't know how much, but water is hydrogen and oxygen. That's the stuff of rocket fuel. Oxygen is really handy for breathing. And so now we're talking about a moon base. And so it's not just sort of going back to the moon to sort of demonstrate prowess, but it is a long-term plan to use the moon as a stepping stone to the rest of the solar system. And I find that incredibly exciting.
And Matthew, while we're focusing on the kind of day-to-day habits and the excitement of sleep and all that sort of thing, you presumably are beginning to wait for data, for the real stuff of science.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm very jealous of them talking about sleep, because I quite like some sleep. But yeah, we've already received data. We received the signals for about 2 hours after launch. We had acquisition of signal this morning about 2:30 local time. We've received and processed the data. We've already sent that back to NASA Goddard to do the analysis. So I just want to pick up on the money point of view as well. We don't put the money into the rocket and launch it. We do spend a lot of money in the local area. So we've had tens of millions of pounds of investment into the Cornish economy from building the antenna that's actually supporting this mission now. So we're building up, we've got high-tech jobs in the area, all because of this space.
I was just watching the live feed, which is now focusing on the Mission Control Centre, and there's a man walking through who's wearing a bow tie, and he's just taking a seat at his desk again. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary thing. Another man's in a waistcoat. It's quite smartly attired in there, Maggie Adarin, but it's a thing to be able to watch this, isn't it? You know, that's obviously a massive change than more than 50 years ago, that there's a sort of community that you can feel you're part of.
Oh, yes, because we are there in Mission Control. And when they were having a few difficulties yesterday, they were sort of dealing with them live, with the whole world listening and watching. And I find that incredible. I must admit, you were talking about the bow tie. I've put on my moon dress.
Excellent.
I've got a smart jacket on because the launch has been successful. So it's sort of dressing up for it, I think.
You've not got your pyjamas on at the other half, have you? Like a lot of people. Because
it's still slippers, but let's not go there.
Okay, you've got your smart blazer on. I mean, but it's that sense of occasion, I suppose, too. To capture, isn't it? That's, I suppose, what you're speaking to.
That's very much so, because these are... now, this is they're not landing on the moon, but they're going further into space than anyone has been before. And so it is sort of these milestones matter. And I think it's also an inspiration for the next generation. I work as a space scientist. I'm trying to recruit the next generation to take on some of the challenges we face. And so, yeah, these moments are really quite important.
And Matthew, for you, and when Nick was just asking there about the data and the science, you know, I'm trying to squint at these figures, 39,400 miles from Earth. And what for you will represent success?
Well, for us, is that we're demonstrating our capability in Cornwall. So we're representing, qualifying the antenna, but also the procedures and the team. So for us, success is that once they've splashed down and we've got all the data back to NASA, and NASA have analysed our systems and our team and compared it to their own, and then we get the opportunity to support the future missions to the moon. And hopefully we'll see data, the 4K video that you're seeing now coming from live from the moon, and I want that to come via Cornwall.
And how soon will we get that next phase, Dame Maggie? We talked yesterday on the programme about a lunar base and then eventually using that base to aim for Mars. Give us a sense of the timescale.
Yes. So this is Artemis 2. So Artemis 1 was an uncrewed mission just to test the SLS, the Space Launch System. This is Artemis 2, so we have a crew on board. I like to say it's like having a new camper van. They're testing out all the systems before they go into deep space. So they're in Earth orbit at the moment and will head out. So Artemis 3 is like an interim. And so, again, it won't land on the moon, but it's testing out the systems. But it's Artemis 4 that will actually get sort of boots on the ground. And that is... predicted for 2028. I think that might be a little optimistic because there's lots of infrastructure that needs to be put in place before this happens. But then they are talking about sort of a moon base, I think, by the close of the decade. And so there's a lot to focus on. But yes, with this moon base, it will be at the South Pole. We'll be investigating that water. Also, and there's the Lunar Gateway, so a fueling system that will be around the moon. So rockets can actually sort of go there, tank up, and then go beyond.
Just briefly, Matthew, the moon, landing on it, that's when the real excitement starts again.
Yeah, absolutely. I most of the team, and including myself, wasn't around for Apollo, and I really want to be able to see the live video, 4K video of someone walking on the surface of the moon and that coming via our systems. And yeah, that will be very, very exciting.
Okay, Matthew Cosby and Dame Maggie Adderin, thank you very much indeed. It's been a day when it's been a pleasure to have a programme filled with some optimism and some joy. Emma and I have enjoyed it. We hope you have. The day man and woman headed to the moon again.
Godspeed, Artemis 2. Let's go.
The rocket is on its own. Four brave explorers ready to ride the most powerful rocket NASA has ever launched. 10, 9, 8, 7. RS-25 engines lit. 4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition.